It's time for Twig This Week in Google. 3 billion users strong. Facebook says no more news for you, Canada. We'll also talk about the move from TV to online advertising, a big gain for both Facebook and YouTube. And it's the end of the line for the incandescent light bulb. All that and more coming up next on Twig.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 727, recorded Wednesday, August 2nd, 2023. Blame it on the Osabuco. This episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by the Building Cyber Resilience Podcast, a show about tech and security from the perspectives of a data scientist, Dr. Ann Irvin, and career CISO Rich Sierson, regarding the intersection of data, finance, and cyber risk management. Search for Building Cyber Resilience on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And by Panoptica. Reduce the complexities of protecting your workloads and applications in a multi-cloud environment. Panoptica provides comprehensive cloud workload protection integrated with API security to protect the entire application lifecycle. Learn more about Panoptica at panoptica.app. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we cover the latest news from the Googleverse. Jeff Jarvis is here. He is the Tau, Leonard Tau Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York, as you would know if you read the New York Times on a religious basis. Hello,
yeah.
Jeff.
Hello, Jarvis. So good to see you all last week in person.
It was really
so
nice
to be there.
You got home safely.
Your hospitality.
I hope you didn't have any trouble navigating.
I got over the bridge.
The bridge.
It was very foggy.
Yeah.
It was extremely foggy, but that made me happy because I couldn't see the ocean.
Yeah. This is an example where phobias can really steer you wrong because you, in fact, want good visibility.
I know.
I was thinking the same thing, but I didn't say anything. But, okay.
That's Ann Pruitt. He is, of course, not only a regular here, but the community manager in our Club Twit community and doing such a great job there. You decided not to make it about coffee.
I pretty much made the photo critique.
Anything you
session,
want.
Whatever the hell you wanted.
You thought that people didn't want to talk about coffee pictures?
I don't know. I was told that it was a bit confusing for some reason.
Well, because coffee time could just be us talking about photos over coffee.
That's the whole point of the phrase is you could take it a lot of different That's why
it was intentionally ambiguous.
Right.
Oh.
You know, I could have just said take pictures of your coffee and you know what would have gotten? A picture of beans or a picture of mugs.
That would be boring. Yeah. Anyway, it's coming up Friday, 4 p.m. You also, I notice, have made it later in the day.
Yes. This will be after This Week in Enterprise Tech.
I can't do the 9 a.m. ones. I really like this. This is a closer to my
9 a.m. is a little too early for you, sir.
Nice. So if you're a member of the club, join us Friday, August 4th, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. For
fun.
I'm going to call it coffee time with Ant. And we have lots of other events coming up. I'm looking forward to that photo walk, too. That's
and by the way, speaking of future events, I was going to email Mr. Jarvis and Searles, but I have you here, too. I want to do like a triangulation of you, Mr. Jarvis, and Mr. Searles in December. We have plenty of warning.
Yeah.
Okay.
We did, didn't we, Jeff, a couple of years ago for our Twit holiday episode, we did the old guys.
Yeah, I remember that for Twit.
It was you, me, Gibson, and I think Doc, was Doc
Mr.
Part of that?
Searles took me a while. No, it's Dr. Searles.
It's Dr. Searles. He's not a doctor. His name is David.
Oh, really?
You know
it's
what?
So funny. I never knew his real name.
His name is David.
I've always called him Doc.
His Doc. His Doc.
Stacey has the week
want
off.
I know that.
Yeah, I know. I don't. David. No.
I know. He's Doc. He's Doc. Yeah. Yeah.
You're grumpy. I'm dopey. And he's Doc.
And he's Doc.
Yeah.
There. Well, stay tuned. I will be in touch with the three of you with the date.
That'd be fun. I'd love to do that. Yeah. Maybe we'll make it our holiday special.
Old farts. Yeah.
Kill two birds with one stone. Hey, Stacey has the week off. She'll be back next week. But She sent us a note saying, I had reserved a camping site, and it came through, so I'm going.
Hey, vacation
season. I'm going. Unexpectedly went through.
But Stacey with no IoT.
No
Stacey IoT. Stacey with just nature.
There's no IoT in Stacey. But well, filling in for Stacey, the wonderful Glenn Fleischman.
Yay!
Yay from Glenn.com. He is right now working on Shift Happens. This is exciting. It's getting close.
Oh my gosh, it's such a big book. I just spent 2 weeks in Maine, about 100 hours on press with the author, with Marcin Wishery, watching the thing come off in pages. So the whole thing is printed now. I mean, I left and it actually didn't hit me. I was staying with a friend for a couple of days afterwards, and she said, so it's all printed now. And it's like, oh, yeah, it is. It was
just not
so
bound.
Much,
it's printed, but it's unbound. Not bound.
It's about one of the two volumes is out of bindery in Massachusetts now. I mean, it's like a war effort. You know, we have all these huge pieces, and just seeing the massive, it was 300,000 sheets of paper went into this thing, like large feet by feet sheets.
Wow.
And, Leo, if you go to Marcin's Mastodon,
okay,
he has a whole set of pictures from the event.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
And Glenn can annotate them for us.
There's a lot of pictures of us frowning at pieces of paper and pointing and
looking at the
photos of like several people standing around all pointing at a thing and frowning, and there was just a lot of looking at things through loops close up, and anyway, it's wonderful, and I learned so much about offset printing and how it's done today. It's going to inform all my future projects, so it was exhausting and great.
Oh, he has put up a ton of pictures.
Name something you learned.
Wow.
I learned that, modern presses, this the folks who went to a press that's not that old, it's only a few years old, and it prints, like a lot of presses, called a perfecting press, which means it prints two sides. And so it prints four colors on one side, that has this very clever thing that flips the paper very gently and prints the other side with four colors, but it can do that at a rate of up to 13,000 sheets an hour. So the paper's going through this machine, even though it's doing eight colors and flipping it in the middle. And in the middle, it's also doing a UV treatment. There's a dryer. So it comes out, the ink is cured and dried, and it's basically a finished page. And I've seen smaller scale efforts before, but they have this huge Star Trek console at the front that lets them see all this registration work's going on, what the ink's being delivered. There's a scanner, so they run it through to check that the registration, the colors are all aligning, and they have so much dynamic control over this thing. The digital has really crept into this very, very analog process, more than I understood viscerally, and now I've seen it and touched it. So that's
super exciting. You delivered PostScript files?
Basically
that became
PDF.
Plates? PDF. A real old PDF that then became plates. But then in the press, they can adjust all kinds of things.
Yeah, they put the plates are, so you start with digital files, you go through proofing stages, but it's all digital or printed out through digital printers, and then they print out these huge metal plates that are exposed by laser in a giant machine, and they put the plates on the press, and then you've kind of, you know, you've glued it's the glue between the digital and the analog, and the press plates are then, you know, they put ink on it, and you see what comes out, and you kind of adjust things on the fly as you need to.
How many sheets do they have to put through before they feel that they've got it make ready enough that it's good?
Hundreds.
They do a lot of spoilage.
Yeah, and then they take the sheets they printed and they run them through for the next. It's called make ready, these early sheets that just are getting the press up to speed, getting things registered. It's like a ship, these presses. There's people at the far end and people at the front, and they have an intercom to talk to the person feeding the paper at the rear, because they have to communicate. No one wants to get mangled in the machine.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Here's the best thing.
How loud is it?
It's not super loud, I would say. It's actually, it doesn't feel that industrial.
What kind of
when
press is it?
Speed.
Is it lithograph? What is it doing?
It's a offset printing press. So it uses offset lithography is a planographic process. So it's flat, and when you expose the plate, some areas attract ink and some attract water. The areas you want to print attract ink. And so as the plates are inserted into each of these units, prints a different color, and as they roll through, water washes them, and then ink is ladled on, and the ink is rubbed basically by pressure onto a rubber blanket, and the rubber blanket rolls onto the paper where it offsets onto the page.
Wow.
And, thus called offset printing, because the plate doesn't touch the paper, rubber blanket. It's incredible.
And there's like 26 ink rollers that all connect for each of these units to avoid having patterns, to avoid harmonics in the ink. It's just every part of it is fractally fascinating to me.
Fractally fascinating. That's could be a show title. Could be.
Very nice. Well, I can't wait. Is it too late to order?
You can still order copies. We have copies left, and they should ship. We're planning on September. The first copies will be out the door. I wanted to mention that I've checked off one box on my Twig scorecard, which is I met Mr. Jarvis in Haverhill, Massachusetts. Ooh. In the flesh.
Yeah,
so that
a
was
lot of it.
It's a very tall man. Do you know how tall Jeff is? You've seen him.
Yes, we know now.
So I should mention that if you go to Shift Happens and you go to the project updates, you can see the images.
Oh, there it is.
Of the printing. Oh, yeah. That would have been a lot easier for you.
Oh, wait, yeah. He's posted that. That's great.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, yeah, lovely people at this place. Lovely thing. And I brought back some printed sheets just so I'd have something to look at in the meantime. But, you know, we're gonna have sample copies of books in our hands shortly. Bad gray. We wrote a bad gray. Was just so
for those
so
of you
much.
On audio, if you go to Shift Happens, you'll see the photos we're talking about.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice.
Shifthappens.site.
Shift Happens.
Well, so that's cutting off the bleed. Oh, that's for the trim.
Yeah, all this stuff.
Oh, that's beautiful. I would love to have that as wallpaper.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So this is the color test strips that are on the edge of the
print. It's all the bars. Yeah, and then those are scanned. So they can use they have a digital process to correct registration. So they scan sheets as they come off. And it takes like three people to run the press. Like two people could run it, but really there's a third supervisor. And then there's three generations of the family that run this company. The oldest is 90. He still goes in every day.
They do not use a UNIVAC to control the machines. This is actually a page from the book.
You can see the color shifts in some of this. I don't know if you can see it.
If you hold there for a minute, Leo, because we went to the Museum of Printing, you see the old huge scanner, right? A scanner to scan an image is as big as your studio at the old cabin, right?
Wow. It's like 15 feet long or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Insane.
And all you do is get a set color separation. So you get the four colors, and that's, you know, one of the plates for one of the colors going by. And that's how we, you know, moved to color printing. And it was an amazing, amazing
moment. People might say $150, that's a lot for this book. But first of all, it's several volumes and a slipcover. It's beautifully. It's four color. But I'm thinking this must cost a heck of a lot just to make.
Just to make it.
It was. The unit cost is not low. Let's say the math all penciled out in the end, which is good for Martin. But it was, it's also we did it in the U.S. for not on principle, but because we wanted to be able to do something like we wanted to talk in similar time zones and
often
be able to go on press
printed in China or elsewhere, right?
Yeah, and then domestic, like shipping by, you know, freighting these books and shipping them USPS will be a lot easier. There's just all these aspects, but it was a good example. So they weren't inexpensive, but they were, I mean, they were competitive with what we thought the book would be worth. So the retail price reflected the quality, and I'm pretty happy with it.
I love it too.
The name of the company?
Oh, it's Penmore Lithographic. Anybody's looking for a nice printer up in Maine, they'll ship your work anywhere. Penmore Lithographics, not an advertisement. Lovely three generations of family run the company, and the oldest, 90 years old, he comes in for about an hour every day. I met him.
Wow.
Lovely fella. And the son and grandson are involved.
He's been doing it.
They run
for
daily
that
operations.
Long. Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. Amazing.
And I love it that the author went in, you and the author went in to watch this and proof it so that it really does, you know, you put a lot of care into this. I think that's amazing.
A lot of, so you look at these photos, you're
that's
like,
one way
like
to do you'll quality see, control.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. See, there's the many people standing and staring at.
Yeah.
Just a lot of time.
That's awesome.
Staring at things, but. Yeah, it's an undertaking, but I think it'll show.
Gee, it looks like really the book's a little smaller than I thought it was going to be.
We were delighted by this folding dummy, so they can make sure the pages were in the right.
Oh, really?
Order.
Oh,
yeah, they made one just so they have a little guide.
It's a little mini book.
That's so cool.
That fits in the palm of your hand, but this is not intended for.
It's not. Sadly, not the.
So behind me, I have some early printing manuals, and getting the right when you're doing multiple pages. One-time impression, to get the right pages, the imposition it's called, in the right place is a really complicated thing. I have a little description in the Gutenberg parenthesis about if just take a piece of paper and I have you fold it and then cut it to give you a sense of what imposition is like.
Wow.
Good.
Great. 6,750 units printed on their way to the binders.
Printing 6,000, but they have to print 6,750 good sheets because there's going to be wastage at every stage. So we don't know how, in binding and...
More than 10%. Wow.
Incredible, incredible technological, physical operation.
What did it smell like?
It doesn't smell that much. The modern inks, really? they're dried. It was super hot. It was in the 80s every day we were there, and they're running a blast furnace at the end to dry the ink when it comes off.
Oh.
And then it's cured by ultraviolet light, which is kind of a newer thing. So it comes off. Yep. It's totally dry. It doesn't really smell that much.
It's
kind of
cool.
A little new book smell. But
for somebody who's a master of the past forms of printing, to see the latest state-of-the-art printing.
Oh my gosh.
It's cool.
So exciting.
I'm quite jealous. I would have loved to have geeked out on that. Yeah.
Next time, there'll be future books, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's get to the thrilled to have you, Glenn. I can't wait for my copy of Shift Happens. And congratulate Marcin for getting it out. And you, of course, were instrumental in having it happen and the Kickstarter and all that. I think it's really great. Very pleased on your behalf. Now, meanwhile, in Canada,
oh boy,
you ain't going to be getting no more news. Meta is already blocking news in Canada. This is over that bill C-18, which is passed and is law. And in response to the law requiring internet giants like Meta and Google to pay news publishers, Meta has said, that's it. No more news for you.
Soup for you.
The Online News Act. Canadian government immediately denounced the move as irresponsible. What the hell?
Wait a minute.
No, that's not irresponsible was the bill.
Right.
The consequences are inevitable.
So there was no one in these meetings that said, you know what could really go wrong here if we propose this bill?
Oh, they were told.
They
were told, including by publishers. Jeff Elgee, we talked on the show before, tried to warn them. Lots of others tried to warn them. Google, Lord knows, tried to warn them.
Right.
I watched testimony by Kent Walker and Richard Gingras before the Senate committee, and they were warned. And now it's going to hurt like hell. But I think what's going to happen is the minister of whatever in charge of the stuff is trying to back up now and say, well, we'll fix this in regulation. If they put
we'll
cap, I think Facebook's news has gone for good. I think Facebook is going to say, hallelujah.
Yeah,
puppies,
they don't want to do this.
Party.
Yeah,
that's all we want. Nothing controversial.
So
let me get this in trouble.
Let me get this straight. Because I don't have a Facebook account, but if I said I wanted to share a link to a New York Times article about my friend Jeff Jarvis on Facebook, could I not do that?
I guess not.
Wow.
And let's not forget that most of the links that, put it differently, all news organizations link to themselves.
Yep.
And they can't
this
do that
is
anymore.
This is what Rachel Curran, Meta's head of public policy in Canada, said. News outlets voluntarily share content on Facebook and Instagram to expand their audiences and help their bottom line. In contrast, we know the people using our platforms don't come to us for news. Meanwhile, Canadian Heritage Minister, it's fitting that the Heritage Minister would be the one who's complaining about all this. You know, back in the day, Canadian Heritage Minister Pascal Saint-Ange, who's in charge of the government's dealings with Meta, said, this is irresponsible. They would rather block their users from accessing good quality and local news instead of paying their fair share to news organizations. And I guess that's where the disconnect happens.
Right.
What's their fair share? What do you mean?
Here's the beauty of this. Here's the great irony of this, right? The platforms were told, your links are worthless. Only our content is worthwhile. Now that the links are gone, they're screaming bloody murder because the links were very valuable to them.
Yeah. We are going.
Jeff, this is much more extensive than the Australian thing, right? The Canada didn't want to use the Australian model, the amended model in Australia.
They did
after
use
they
it.
Tried something similar. So they already knew what could happen. They'd seen the outcome, and the Canadian government said, we're going to go ahead with this thing that already failed in a country with a maybe similar aspect as ours.
They went further than Australia. They did use Australia as a model. But in Australia, the weird thing is, Glenn, that there was a kind of a trigger. And the trigger didn't get triggered. So that the money that Facebook and Google pay to publishers in Australia is voluntary. They were not forced into negotiation.
Huh.
They were not forced into anything. And so in Canada, it was different. It was, no, you must negotiate. And if you don't, we're going to send you to arbitration and you're going to pay through the nose. And so this time, the only option that the platforms had was to say, well, no, then we're not going to have news and there's nothing to negotiate.
It sounded like they just want a free ride.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Just a free ride.
Well, their argument is, and I think that everybody on this panel agrees it's not right, but their argument is we're standing up against the tech giants. They're using our content for free. We want them to pay for it.
They're driving you traffic.
Yeah. And what they miss, the point they miss is these are private businesses that can make the business choice, which they have, not to drive that traffic because we don't want to pay for it.
All right.
They're not actually, it's funny because Google and Meta aren't really disputing that that might have value. They're just saying, well, we don't care that much, so we just won't do it anymore.
Right.
And now what? Now what do you do?
Bigger fish to fry.
The Saint-Ange said they would rather block their users from, oh, I said that. We're going to keep standing our ground. After all, if the government can't stand up for Canadians against tech giants, who will? This is a very misguided, quixotic stand, if you ask me.
Well, isn't this the whole push-pull about where the, I mean, it's both about where the value lies, but it's sort of about where the money goes. And I know publishers have been angry for decades since the rise of, let's say, Craigslist, even our friend Craig Newman, that any money that they deem as belonging to them as a media company is shifted to some online source. And sometimes I think it's justified but they're right to feel like, something happened and the value we're bringing, like having articles, is being used by somebody else. They're taking the text, they're previewing it, they're doing something that reduces our ability to, bring in revenue. But I feel like there's always a sense of like, well, we're obliged to receive that revenue because we do it. On the flip side, how did Twitter and Facebook and other companies rise? Like, where does their advertising revenue come from? At one point, it was because people went there to read some parts of news or discuss news. I feel they sucked a lot of value, a lot of advertising dollars off of newspapers in particular. But I don't know if you can, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, but is there a way to produce something that's fair that doesn't simply say, well, you just give billions back to media companies?
Well, what they were trying to do, what Google was trying to do, was to say, we're doing Showcase, we're giving grants. They were trying to say a few things. One, we need a cap on this. You can't say that there's some formula out there that we don't know and we're going to have to agree to and we don't know where the end of it is. We'll pay some money to news for the benefit of news. We're a good citizen. We'll do that.
Yes.
The second thing Google said to them was, the government shouldn't really be involved in this. Why don't you set up an independent organization panel that would decide who's in and who's out? Because that's a huge issue, right? Because the largest a newspaper company in Canada is owned by controlled by a hedge fund, American hedge fund. So we know what's going to happen. The money's going to go to the American hedge fund's bottom line. It's fungible. It's not going to support journalism. The Toronto Star is now owned by investors. It's going to go to the investors. And a lot of little guys are going to get left out. And a lot of native publications are going to get left out. And so why don't you have a separate organization that can adjudicate all this? And the government said, no, to both. We're going to do it our way. Well, now, I think they're going to try to back up and write regulation around this law that gets around the worst of it, find a way to cap and come back. And Google, I'm going to predict, will probably come back to the table because, news has some benefit to search customers there.
Yep.
But Facebook, I'll bet, is never coming back. Facebook's going to say, thank you very much for letting us prove how much we don't need you.
Meta has said that links, according to Reuters, to news articles make up less than 3% of the content on its users' feeds and say it lacks economic value. So you're right. It may be a value to Google, but it isn't a value to Facebook. It's just a pain in the butt.
And the value to the Google is limited. The value to Google, I think, is between 4% and 6% of stuff. And so most of it is not. And there's other places you can go to find news. You can go, fine. You want people to go straight to your homepage? Fine.
Let them go.
And
wasn't
they can go
there a
there
survey that basically said that most people aren't getting their news from social media, be it Facebook or what have you, that they're actually going to the source more so than...
No, they're still going to the social media, but they're getting linked to the sources then. And so Jeff Elgee, who we talked about 2 weeks ago, said he will immediately lose 50% of his traffic for Village Media.
because it's shared on Facebook first.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, okay. Facebook and Twitter. This sounds like fighting a
battle of years ago where, you know, page views were the thing. And now most publications want subscribers. And you'd think they'd maybe want to do anything that would produce a stickiness for someone to pay that fee. I mean, are page views worth that much?
That's what I love about you is your innocent view of the world. You're absolutely right. But they also want bakshish.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same exact conversation going around AI and copyright right now. Barry Diller and company are out there saying, we want billions from these AI companies, even though there are doctrines of fair use, and even though the AI is transformative, and even though there's no necessarily clear copyright case. They see, like, it's like the cartoon animals with dollar signs in their eyes going round and round and round and round and round. So, yes, they want subscribers. Yes, they want to build relationships. No, they don't know how to, and still they want bribery money, blackmail money.
Obviously, if Google or Facebook published the entire article so that you didn't have to read it anywhere, you could read the whole thing on Google or Facebook.
Yeah,
there would be some legitimate concern about that.
Oh, well, they pay for that. They license it in New Show's case now.
Yeah,
they license it.
It's a little snippet, and it's really not enough to keep you from going to the site, unless...
Here's the irony, Leo. I did tests years past where actually the longer the snippet, even unto a full article, is the best ad and has the highest click-through.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, what next you go after social networks like X or Threads and say...
Can we agree not to say that ever again?
No, I don't want to say Twitter because that's a copyright of ours. We're just going to say X. I'm thrilled. Are you kidding? I'm thrilled. It's X. Let Elon... There's another one. Let him... He wanted it. Let him stew. Let him stew in it. Why is Lisa looking at me through the porthole?
Because she's... I guess she agrees.
I thought your mic is about to get cut.
What you probably read, Ant, was an interesting science article that came out this week that found that, in fact, social media does not really polarize people. They were studying Instagram and Facebook to study the effects of social media on the attitudes and behavior of users during the election. Jeff, you read these originating papers. Can you summarize?
This is a project run. Quick little background, if I may. So Talia Stroud and Josh Tucker, Talia is at UT Austin and Josh Tucker is at NYU, are brilliant researchers in this. They've been working in this area. There was a project called Social Science One, which Facebook was going to share data with researchers. It was a disaster because Facebook couldn't figure out how to do it by protecting privacy. Some of the data turned out to be wrong. It was a mess. This is a reset. They came back and 17 researchers worked with Meta, receiving no money from Meta. Absolute independence, but Meta researchers also worked with them. They couldn't get the raw data because of privacy reasons, which, you know, we can debate that around Cambridge Analytica precedence here. They're going to do a total of 12 papers. These are the first four papers that came out. And so they found, for example, that people say, well, it's the algorithm that's causing all of this mess, right? So they gave people for 3 months, who, by the way, were... consented to this test. They weren't just guinea pigs. They gave people for 3 months as a group purely reverse cron, the thing that Leo has been screaming he wants. Well, results were that they actually used it less because it wasn't as good a feed to them, and it had no impact whatsoever on their political views or differences. Well, if it's not the algorithm, then it's this damn sharing thing. It's making things go viral. That's what's wrong.
Yep.
So they tested showing people nothing shared from their friends. Also, no impact at all. And I believe in both cases, they saw more disinformation than before. Now, there's a lot of ifs and ands and in this research, and there were two other papers that were interesting as well. But generally, the reflexive knee-jerk responses, it must be the algorithm, kill the algorithm. Well, let's test it, let's do some real research. And the research says not what you think. Same with research over the years about filter bubbles not being real. Same with about echo chambers not being real. And now the algorithm and virality aren't necessarily as bad. The problem remains that we're screwed up as human beings.
Science.org quotes one of the researchers, a political scientist at Dartmouth, Brendan Nyhan, saying, no one is saying this means social media has no negative effects.
Right.
But these three little experiments, interventions they did, none of them measurably changed attitudes. So I think that tells
us. So it's not the fix,
something.
In other words. We think, oh, well, we understand how to fix all this. Well, no, it doesn't fix anything.
The results of these experiments do not show that the platforms are not the problem, double negative, but you get what it is. But they do show they're not the solution. So that's important. This isn't saying, no, people aren't influenced by the platforms, but we can't modify the algorithm in such a way that it makes people not be influenced. Less influence.
Well, it also says, you know, the problem is the research we don't have is to have us, and this is, I've talked to Josh Tucker about this a lot, is we need the data to get somebody's full sense of their full media exposure. What stupid podcasts do they watch?
Yeah.
What stupid websites do they
I think you
to?
Could argue what 24, you could tell what person, what your political slant would be from which 24-hour news channel you watch.
Yeah. True. Yeah. And you bring that to Facebook, and you share that.
Right.
The other thing that they did was they looked at things that were fact-checked. And sorry, folks, but it's asymmetrical as hell that the disinformation is shared on, guess what, the right.
Yeah.
Where they bring it to the platform.
Yeah. I mean, it's very puzzling to me when you see the polls and you see, for instance, Donald Trump matching Joe Biden, even some of the people polled say, even though he's being accused of crimes and maybe even is a criminal, we're still going to vote for him. And it really, it makes you, for people on the left like me, to go, what the heck? But it really is just a different worldview. When you see Scott Adams, the Dilbert cartoonist, Xing on X. Well, the big news story, this whole Donald Trump indictment is just to hide the fact that we've got some testimony in the Hunter Biden story is like, that's a different, to me, somebody on my end of the political spectrum is a different, you're not in the same universe as me. Well, and I'm sure they feel the same way about us, but I don't think that's because of Facebook doesn't have, or Twitter doesn't have that much impact.
But it's so transactional, right? It's, you know, Benghazi stopped being a problem when they stopped talking about Benghazi. The server, you know, all the every wave of this is done specifically, and it's tailored for this. So we are maybe confused why, as high information people, let's pretend we are, who read a lot of news and try to be fair about things, we're confused when low information folks take the point of view of people who have changed their stories. The caravan coming up from Mexico suddenly disappeared when the election was over, etc. Like all these things that have happened at different times that are. You know, cobbled together, we don't see centrist or left-wing media being able either doing it or being able to pull it off and have the saturation that right-wing media.
Well, but
can.
I'm also trying really hard not to call people low information and trying to say,
I don't think it's an insult. I think it's
we have different. If you don't, well, I mean, that implies I know what's true and you don't.
Right.
And while I believe that, I think it's, to be fair, we'll just say we disagree.
Oh, God. More information you have, don't you feel you have a smaller grasp on what's actually true sometimes?
Yeah.
Though?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I think low information, and maybe I'm not getting the academic term here right, are people who avoid seeking additional information that might change their worldview. They typically are single sourced, or they use whatever, and they take that as a way to sort it out for themselves.
It makes sense, because I'm not seeing opposing points of view.
Yeah, and high information, you take in lots of viewpoints, but that can be dramatically more agitating and confusing. And there are plenty of people who are high information folks.
It's just that they're super stressed out because they've got so much information coming to them.
Yeah. Well, that's the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is the more you know, the less you know, and the less you know, the more you know.
Right.
Yeah. The more confident you are about it, the less you know, the more confident you are, you know the most. And the people who know the most are least confident that they know the most.
Right, yeah.
Leo, can you do me a favor and go to, on X, Decoding Fox News?
Actually, I want to do this first because it's related. X is suing a group, because we were just talking about this science article about research done on Facebook. X is actually suing a group that researched hate speech on the platform.
Because, Mr. Free Speech, Mr. Free Speech for All, Mr. Absolute Free Speech-ish.
They say by investigating that, you created a scare campaign that drove away advertisers. I don't even think they're saying in this lawsuit, oh, there isn't any hate speech. I think they're just saying we just don't want you to access our content. X thinks that all of that stuff on X is theirs, not ours, because they have the platform. And as a result, they're actually saying it's a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is really an inappropriate stretch. They're suing the Center for Countering Digital Hate. The founder and chief executive said the legal threat shows that Elon Musk will stop at nothing to silence anyone who criticizes him for his own decisions and actions. I presume the court will throw this out because maybe they'll say, well, you're not allowed to access X anymore to do the research, which is, I'm sure, what Elon's been trying to do all along.
I don't know what precedent that LinkedIn case has in this case.
That was the scraper case. Yeah.
Right. Scraping. I don't know if that's the case.
I don't know. Anyway, I only mention that because this science article talks about studies that were done, I presume, with the cooperation of Meta, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So Meta cooperated greatly. They devoted a staff to it, $20 million of cost. It was the whole project had a rapporteur, a watchdog over it, an independent scholar who wrote a long piece in Science about his views of it. And in the end, he said it was independence with permission. So he was complaining about it. Well, okay. Point well taken. Meta did not interfere with the research questions that researchers asked, but the researchers couldn't see again the raw data. Why? Cambridge Analytica. Why? GDPR. So they can't give the raw user data to the researchers. Now, what's necessary, I think, there is for government to intervene. Yes, I said it. Government to intervene.
Oh, boy.
To give safe harbor to a Facebook
for research.
And say, for research, you must hand over the data.
Yeah.
We will say how it happens.
But
you
are not
liable. Get in trouble for it.
Yeah, you're, yeah.
Right.
Meanwhile, I mean, so those are I'm just saying those are contrasting points of view. Twitter
yes,
will
are.
Sue you for trying to do
it. Twitter was when it was still Twitter. Twitter was the best at this.
They used to hand
Researchers
this stuff over.
Were,
yeah.
Yeah. Now the API is gone and expensive and so on. Twitter was the kind of the only mechanism we had to judge how social media worked. And of course, it was its own odd little corner of social media.
So that's it. That was our only Twitter story of the week. So thank you very much.
Can we mention my graduate? Can I plug my graduate?
Sure.
Decoding Fox News. A woman named Juliette Jeske is doing incredible work. I have been saying for a long time that I was on MSNBC Air when they still had me on, saying I wish you would do a feature called We Watch Fox News So You Don't Have To. So that's what Juliette does. And I helped fund it from my center at the school to get going. And she was the one person out there who quoted Greg Gutfeld's obnoxious statement about the Holocaust, such that the White House responded to it. And she's getting huge attention right now. She's brave as can be because, of course, they go after her regularly. She has a Substack and YouTube and X. But look at Decoding Fox News because the point of it is we need to look and see what that part of America is seeing and not seeing, right? The morning after the indictments of the former president, I turned on Fox News and what were they talking about? One guess, Hunter Biden.
Yeah. I turned on Gutfeld the other night when the Trump indictment came down. I guess that was last night. Feels like a year ago.
Boy, doesn't it ever.
They were talking about Hunter Biden and not at all about the Trump indictment. Gutfeld is really an interesting, it's an entertainment show. It's supposed to be funny and humorous, and he's actually fairly funny. But from the Fox point of view, it's kind of an interesting thing.
Yes. It's a phenomenon that also needs study.
On our cable, it's right next to CNN. So Lisa will say, well, let's just see what they're saying.
Yeah.
On the other side there. And I think that's another way to do it. But you can also look up Decoding Fox News. She has a podcast. She has a Substack. Sounds like a good... In the podcast, does she play clips?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and on the video, she does clips quite a bit. Yeah. She put up the Gutfeld clip, but then he accused her of
selective
faming her. So she put up more.
Oh. Yeah. Let's get the context. Oh, it's the same. Let's take a little break. We have more to talk about. Jeff Jarvis, Aunt Pruitt, and our special guest star, Glenn Fleischman. Great to have you. We are going to give you the traditional SAG-AFTRA background actor fee of $148 for this appearance. So thank you.
This is just me from previous appearances.
Yeah, we've digitized you. So you get nothing. Our show today brought to you by another great podcast, the Building Cyber Resilience Podcast. The world is hyper-connected like never before. This advanced technology-driven landscape is creating smarter businesses to better serve customers. But as you know, this territory also comes with threats. The hosts, fantastic hosts, by the way, Dr. Ann Irvin, she's a chief data scientist and VP of product management at Resilience. And her co-host, Rich Sireson, is chief risk officer. They talk about the positive outcomes of developing risk management and utilizing data science across industries to create a smarter business. Data science to me is fascinating. And to tie it into the fields of risk management and cybersecurity really is an interesting kind of synergy. They meet with the top experts and innovators in these fields to discuss the changing cyber landscape, its constantly evolving risks. They talk about how businesses are beating the bad guys, how businesses are managing risk and crisis without impacting the value to their customers. The Building Cyber Resilience team answers these questions and more. They just did one that you might be interested in on AI. Will ChatGPT replace the underwriter? They talked to the chief strategist of AI and machine learning for, get ready for this, the U.S. Department of Defense, the DOD, as well as the CRO of Symmetry Systems. They discuss how AI is being used for cyber attacks, how it affects defense and defensive roles in security. Really interesting stuff. Learn how you can build a cyber resilient organization. Building Cyber Resilience. Search it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll put a link in our show notes too at twit.tv/twig. So you can just click that. I think a really great subject and a very well done podcast. Thank you to the Building Cyber Resilience podcast for supporting our podcast this week in Google.
Cyber resilience is something that our friend Craig Newmark cares deeply about.
Yeah. I was unfamiliar with the term until I started listening to the podcast, and that makes a lot of sense. It's very interesting. Because you can't say, let's build a brittle wall. You have to be resilient. You know, it can't be, it has to, you know, it's like a tree that bends in the wind instead of a solid brick wall that just blows right over.
Mm-hmm.
We got some results from Google, the quarterly results.
Ooh.
And yeah, one of the most interesting one to me was how well YouTube did in advertising.
Did we talk about that last week?
Did we? All right.
We talked about some.
Well, and let me just throw this in. This is an article that came out yesterday from The Information, Sahil Patel.
Oh, okay. So this is a good follow-up, yeah.
The follow-up is Hollywood's pain is YouTube's advertising gain, because Google's been pushing very hard into live sports. You know, they got the NFL games starting in September on YouTube TV. Top executives at several ad agencies told The Information they're going to spend 10 to 20% more with YouTube this fall than they did last year. Now, you couple that with a statistic that traditional TV networks are saying advertising is down 15%. It looks like a good amount of that money is moving away from traditional television and into YouTube. So that's, I guess, very good news for YouTube. There's a $70 billion a year market. Television advertising has been, dominant forever. But it does lack, and we've talked a little bit about this, it lacks the information about the audience that digital platforms can offer. YouTube, Patel writes, had already made some inroads into the TV ad market in recent years, helped by the growing consumption of YouTube videos on TV. Nearly 45% of YouTube viewing in the U.S. now occurs on TV screens. Almost half.
I'm fine with that.
Do you watch YouTube on TV?
All the time.
And the hard hits too?
All the time.
And I'm not just talking about YouTube TV. I'm talking about YouTube.
General YouTube.
Yeah.
General YouTube.
Yeah, I was always, like, I'd come home, this is years ago, and Henry and his friends would be sitting around, and there'd be YouTube on the TV, and they would listen to music that way, among other things.
All the time.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people listen to podcasts via YouTube, which is wild. I still don't quite get that, but I think it's the convenience.
Yeah.
Right, but the convenience of it. I think
just
that's
play
the
it
thing.
In the background. It's
their everything app, so you just use YouTube. Why do I need a podcast app? But to search or subscribe there.
Is it safe to say a lot of these numbers are coming from the fact that TVs aren't dumb anymore? It's hard to find a dumb TV. Everybody's got some form of television that's connected to the internet. Even though not everybody has super high speed internet, people still have these smart TVs out there. And of course, they see something like YouTube right there on a 50-inch screen. Why not click on it?
Well, and let's not forget that the strike with the Screen Actors Guild and the Writers Guild of America is going to hobble traditional television.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meanwhile, it doesn't hurt YouTube at all, right? These people aren't union workers.
Right.
Mr. Beast is going to still crank out the content.
Yep.
I would like to lobotomize my television, frankly. I don't want a smart TV. I want to...
Mine is not even connected to the internet. I use Xbox One as my smart TV, and it works totally fine.
Dwayne, are you suggesting that the smart TVs accelerated cord cutting?
I think so.
Because you were already connected to the internet.
Yeah, it just made it so easy. And then you saw, wait a minute, I can save $100 a month, and that's a lot of money. So why not just cut it off and move on to just watching the streaming services, because their content is still pretty good for now.
By the way, Facebook.
Go ahead. Oh, just quick. Curious about your habits and the family. Do you watch YouTube on the big TV together, or does everybody grab their time?
Most of the time, we sort of segregate to different. You know, they watch it in their room. I watch it in the living room, and you know, they're generally just watching whatever creator that they enjoy. When we watch it together, it's most of the time with me, because I tend to bounce around on a lot of different things. You know, we'll watch some docs and watch hot ones and just some weird things to laugh at, you know, and it's just entertainment, you know, and it's premium, so I don't get the ads interrupting ads.
On the fence with that. Yep.
So men are accused of being horrible with remote controls, and women just want to, you know, slap their hands down. Does Queen Pruitt sit there and tell you to switch around on YouTube, or are you good with YouTubers?
No discussion whatsoever, because the one TV that I do watch, no one comes and touch that remote except me, because it's sort of seen as that's TV.
So Dad had an armchair back in the day with his butt imprint in it. Now he's got a TV that goes with it.
Yeah, exactly what goes on. And then television.
And Queen, did you read that article about the Zenith clicker? The miracle is the Zenith clicker.
What? Incredible. Sorry, I don't mean to get us off track, but that was amazing.
Do you remember
it
that?
It was.
Are old enough to remember, so it was a box with only four buttons.
Yeah,
the buttons were really limited. One was to turn the volume up, one was to turn the volume down, one was to, you could only go up on channels.
Right.
Right. I can't remember what was the fourth one. Was it on off?
Probably power. It might have been on off.
So it didn't use a battery. It wasn't radio. It wasn't line of sight. How do you think it worked?
It was all wired?
Nope.
No.
This is a little puzzle.
Apparent.
It had inside, so you'd press it, and you remember, Glenn, it would do like a little
weird clicking sound.
That's where the clicking came from, the name clicker,
clicker.
Yeah.
You would press it, and inside the box there were little metal chimes.
It was like a tuning fork kind of thing, or
play an inaudible tune. It was such a high frequency. Yeah. It was ultrasonic.
Ultrasonic polyphonic. There's
That's
the episode
not real.
Title. No, it's for sure.
That's
the
not
TV,
real.
The
it
TV
is real.
Received it. The TV received it and acted on it mechanically.
Dude.
Incredible. So there were I've forgotten the term. It's in the article. There is solid state circuitry that when it received it, it would actually produce
on the TV.
A physical
because it was powered, but
incredible.
The remote didn't have to be.
Wow.
By pressing a button, you set off a spring-loaded hammer that struck a solid aluminum rod in the device, which rung out at an ultrasonic frequency.
Oh, my God.
Each button had a different length rod, so a different tone, and the TV was able to decode that. There was a microphone in the TV.
And to our ear, when you push the button, it did click.
Yeah, it went click. Yeah, but it was more like a thump.
Dogs would start going nuts.
I did not know. I don't think, I mean, it wasn't widely known what was going on. It was just magic.
On off.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I'm sorry to, yeah, but it was, that's as smart as a TV I want. I can hear ultrasonic, four ultrasonic commands. Give me that. That's all I want.
Glenn wants his Sylvania back.
Maybe upgrade to a Zenith.
Wow. Wait a minute. Actually, they have video. Let me see if my audio's on here. Let's see.
The Zenith Click.
You can hear it.
Incredible. Incredible technology.
There it is.
Yeah.
There it is.
That sounds straight up like a toy you get out of Big Lots.
But it's playing a tone that you can't hear on a little aluminum rod.
Dude, that's crazy.
EC.
Yeah. Amazing.
And the actual buttons, I was wrong. There was channel goes down, channel goes up, volume mutes, and then off and on. So you could change the channel. You couldn't change the volume. You can only mute it.
I had a TV in that era. My family, we had a TV. We didn't have a lot of money. Sometimes the color would go out. We had to hit the side of it, and the color came back.
Not
making this up.
Yeah.
They used to sell. Well, I remember getting in trouble with my father when the first color TV arrived in our house. If you played with the dials, which of course was fun, right?
Yeah, everybody's green.
It was like doing this on me, you know. Right? And you do that. And it was fun to do. And then, the TV's not aligned anymore. And look what you've done. Everyone looks
He's
like
all
blue.
He's all blue. Remote controls used to play back ultrasonic frequencies, says Grandma. Sure, Grandma, let's get you to bed.
That's amazing.
I love it.
Very good.
Anyway, that was a little sideline. Let's get back to the future.
That's what I'm here for.
Facebook. Wow. Ad revenue, its quarterly results came out this week, up 12%. Everybody, remember Facebook was saying, Apple's going to kill us.
It's dead.
Yeah. Kill us.
We'll never be able to find ad revenue.
12%. This is from Next in Media, a Substack. Clearly, a good number of Facebook's 10 million advertisers are finding the platform to be effective. The company says it's due to an investment in AI.
Oh, here we go.
I'm not sure if I trust Facebook since they said Apple was killing it and they're up 10%. But Reels is doing really well, right?
They were forced to innovate, right? They had something taken away that they thought was easy, and they made a huge profit off, and they got lazy, and they have some challenge now. And apparently they rose to some of it, at least on the revenue side.
Yeah, you got to get
until we find out
points.
If they were overstating results, which is not financial.
Happened.
I don't want to accuse them of that.
No.
Overstating click-through and financial results
views,
from
impressions. Yeah.
Pivot to clickers.
I think TikTok, Reels, Facebook, Google, these are all threats to the mainstream television. And I wish I could say podcasting, but no. We're not in that list. A good article that I wanted people to take a look at from IAPP.org, the United States Privacy Digest. A view from D.C. Ad tech is built on a privacy fault line.
Hmm.
Change is coming for digital advertising, challenging our long-term experiment in ubiquitous personalization. This could mean the end of millions of dollars of marketplace value, the author Kobun Zweifel-Keegan writes, or it could mean innovative, privacy-centric adaptations for advertising technology. He's talking about the tension between people who want our personal data to stay personal, right? And the demand from advertisers to get more information. And, of course, United States privacy laws haven't really yet cracked down on data brokers and other things.
Yeah.
Apple's got a feature
coming in the new operating systems, an update to Safari that's coming this fall, that it blocks user identifiable fingerprinting and tracking, starting with... It's an advanced feature. It only is enabled for private browsing, and it essentially suppresses all URL-based link tracking. So all those UTM underscore codes. Mm-hmm. So if you're in private browsing mode, it won't use those, but you can change it as a user and change it from private browsing to all, and you can clip all link-based tracking. And Apple has cracked down on, over the years, every version of Safari just about has had an increased reduction in tracking. The app tracking was, you know, app-wide across all of iOS and iPadOS. But this is Safari increasingly, as Google's trying to do its workaround effort, Apple just keeps saying, well, if you're going to play those games, we're going to just keep ratcheting it down because we don't make very much money off advertising. We make money off saying we are selling privacy.
So, Mr. Fleischman, that's only for UTM links, not anything, something like what we use for our sponsors. You know, it'll be...
Depends, right? So they said they're using it's Facebook, UTM, and some other popular links, but Apple is not fully disclosing at this point what they're going to block. So I expect they will evolve patterns that they use to recognize. So over time, there could be more and more... but again, it's only initially by default. Users will get it only when they're using private browsing as a way to reduce user identifiability when they're specifically signaling they want to be anonymous.
Okay.
But it's the kind of thing that Apple could roll out to the everybody side as an option. Like, hey, do you want to have no tracking of any of your clicks anywhere?
We did talk last week about the Web Integrity API, which is a stealth proposal from Google to really build in fingerprinting into Chrome. And this is actually relevant to this from article from the International Association of Privacy Professionals, because he says each day the targeted advertising infrastructure is inching close to collapse. Those who build and maintain the ad tech metropolis now face a decision: shore up defenses around their strategic interests with slight tweaks. That's kind of what Google's doing in creative legal theories, buying themselves as much time as possible, or rebuild before the crash. He says targeted advertising is on the way out. Not just individuals like you and me who run ad blockers and try as much as we can to defeat it, but to governments all over the world who are now really investigating it in the EU and elsewhere.
Did you see what Meta is offering to do?
No.
So they say that they're going to seek, for Europe, they're going to seek consent for highly targeted ads. It's line 104.
Yeah, no, we talked about that. That basically undermines everything Google and Facebook do. It's like if a user can say, no, I don't want to be targeted. The problem really, I don't think it's necessarily that Google wants to do this. I think advertisers demand it. I know this is our experience. We don't want to track anybody. Mm-hmm. But
advertisers are saying, show us where we're making our money.
Yeah, we won't get the ad buys because we can't compete with Google and Facebook. We don't, we give them as little information as possible, and it really is privacy protective, I believe. But they demand it, and honestly, they want more and more. Patel writes, moving away from today's data-driven ad tech architecture will require coordinated effort on multiple fronts, redesigning architectures of consumer choice, bringing to market new privacy-enhancing technologies, standardizing contractual arrangements between market participants. But he says, we've got to do this because it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And he talks about the IAB and its multi-state privacy agreement trying to standardize the legal conversation. That's not going to happen. You've got too many constituencies. The Senate Commerce Committee has two new Kids Online Safety Acts, COSA, which is a terrible bill. But this is, this is because people want privacy, right?
I think there's
also because of the get ready ant moral panic around it.
I think there's... Uh-oh.
I got a bad feeling about this.
That's great. I think there are 10 states now that have... California was first with a...
But that's right.
Nine others. I was just looking it up literally this morning for an unrelated reason. And some of the laws won't go into effect until 2022 or 2024 to 2026. But I believe it's four or five states have laws in effect. But, Montana, Utah, Texas, Virginia, these are not necessarily, this is not a blue red state issue necessarily. It's more about how the legislatures in those states, who's trying to prevent this and where they're, where the lobbyists are and where the consumer activist groups are.
So this is, IAPP is a privacy advocacy group, and this is them saying, something's got to give. I gave the wrong byline. It's Kobun Zweifel's Keegan, not Patel. That was a previous article.
I think I might have been on a board of advisors there, but I can't remember.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good group, and I hope they're right. I do think there is this tension between advertisers who want to know more and more, companies who are giving them more and more, and we, the users, who want them to know less and less.
Well, and media cannot eat by subscriber bread alone.
Right. Yeah, right? I mean, that's so advertising absolutely a conversation. Now, actually, that's one of the things he says is don't conflate the two, that just because you can't have targeted advertising doesn't mean you can't have ad-supported media. In fact, I think we've had this conversation now on Security Now. We had it on Windows Weekly. I don't think there's a lot of evidence that you do have to have targeted advertising for advertising to work.
Research on that.
Yeah. I think that's the thing advertisers want.
Nobody wants to argue with the person who has the checkbook.
Right. And if they're demanding it, right? He says, some claim that the death of targeted advertising is equivalent to the death of ad-supported fallacy. Ad-supported internet. That is a fallacy. I think the ad-supported fallacy is maybe a Freudian slip. Ad value is not, he says, intrinsically tied to the extraction of personal data. That's, I think, the fundamental question. Is it? Advertisers think it is.
There needs to be some mechanism for relevance and efficacy. Right? Don't show me ads for pregnancy clothes, because I'm not pregnant, I'm not a woman, and you're going to waste your money. So, and if you do, if we just go back to a pure billboard world, then you're showing me a lot of junk. I mean, the web's getting junked up.
Yeah, but it's not my duty to make sure advertisers don't waste, well, I'm as an end user, not as a podcast host, but it's not my duty to make sure advertisers don't waste their money. That's not an end user's obligation.
You may make the argument.
I don't want to see.
Irrelevant to me.
I mean, we were talking on Windows Weekly. I see for some reason Instagram has decided I need T-shirts for fat men, and so I get a lot of ads for T-shirts.
I just got those too. What's going on?
How do they know?
What are they trying to tell us? They just started showing up.
I think that's actually yes. Okay, so that's targeted, and no offense, Glenn, but I think both of us probably should wear those.
Yeah, I guess I need some of those shirts.
So, but
do we want advertising though?
I mean, this is insulted. Actually, this is a fundamental question. That's bad advertising because it's perfectly targeted.
But this is Apple's privacy or it's a private relay feature they offer for their paid subscribers to iCloud Plus. It has this interesting fuzziness, and some of the OpenDNS, some of the DNS public DNS providers working on this is to push out an IP address that is quasi geolocated. So it tells you an advertiser would know you're in the country or you're in a region, mm-hmm. which could be useful without saying, I live at 123 any place street in any town USA. And I actually kind of want, I would be less offended by advertising if it were less offensive, like those short ads, but targeted to me. I mean, I think that's the problem. Is
but
most
that's
advertising
targeted to you though, right? If it gets it right, what's the problem with that?
Well, if it doesn't, I don't want them to know so much about me. I always feel it's a victory when YouTube gives me ads that are obviously wrong. I feel like I'm doing something right in my interactions because they aren't giving me targeted ads. But I don't mind getting ads for things that I actually am interested in. We're in capitalism. Advertising is a part of it. Mm-hmm. I'm part of an advertising economy. Mm-hmm. If I see an ad that's good, that's okay. But I'm mostly offended by the ads that are delivered to me. They're mostly
that are too good,
they're seeking attention. Like, my family, we stopped watching, we stopped really watching cable or broadcast TV, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, and just kind of did some cable channels that didn't have ads or muted them or were watching streaming and whatever. So my kids grew up without ads, and it's funny to watch them interact with advertising because they basically treat it like an interactive medium where they're just continuously talking back to the ad if they see one. And they're so critical of it. And we watch ads. Sometimes we'll be watching something. Well, this is a broadcast thing. Or it was taped from, I taped it off the air, and it'll be like, oh my God, let's watch these ads because it's so hard for them to get attention now. They're like screaming. They're showing incomprehensible images they've learned from YouTube. So something is deeply broken, and targeting certainly didn't solve that, right?
No, it didn't.
All right.
I really can't do an ad right now, can I?
I can't. Well, I want to do an ad, but I can't. So
Lisa's back at the portal window.
Yeah. We'll pivot. I think Joe made an appropriate poster here. It's not my job to make sure advertisers aren't wasting their money. Oh, wait.
No, but listen, I'm going to defend, Leo, I'm going to defend you to yourself, which is, this is the whole point. People find affinity media. They like this program. They come to it and yes. you give them things yes. that people like this sort of thing will probably like this sort of thing, right? You wisely avoided doing crypto advertising, but even though you knew people watching the show might like some of it and you made the right call there, but you know, it's if you were suddenly advertising Rogaine in every episode, it might become a little I'm sorry, the next sponsor is Rogaine. We did do
manscaping for a while.
Yeah, I remember that.
I think that's within parameters.
And yeah. I think we had a ED we advertiser did. For a while.
Yeah, we sure did. Roman. So,
that's nothing wrong with that.
Not against him. Nothing.
Well, you can see I'm not a Rogaine customer, so I don't know.
Hey, some really good news. The family of Henrietta Lacks has settled a lawsuit over the use of her cell line. She, in the 50s, 1951, a biotech company somehow got a hold. Actually, doctors at Johns Hopkins extracted cervical cells. They were treating her cancer. A physician at the hospital noticed that Henrietta Lacks' cells reproduced at a very high rate and started actually cultivating them to use for medical research without telling her or her family. They are called HeLa cells. And perhaps you've seen read the book about all of this. They've been used to treat, to create COVID vaccines, the polio vaccine, to test toxins, drugs, and cancer treatments. They even went to space, but her family never got compensation for the use of her cells. They sued in 2021. There was a book called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks that many of you I know have read. They have now settled the lawsuit with Thermo Fisher Scientific, which is the biotech company that commercialized the cell line on her 103rd birthday, or what would have been her 103rd birthday, as a matter of fact. So no details, as is often the case with these kinds of settlements, no details on what the settlement was. But I hope they got a nice, healthy check for the use of the HeLa.
Well, the lawyer folks I know, they say whenever there's a settlement, that means neither side of the coin is happy, so it must be good.
Yeah. You're supposed, having been involved in this at one point, you're supposed to say, they give you the language. Our dispute was settled to the mutual satisfaction of both parties.
There, yeah, that. Yeah,
which
that's
means
it.
Mutual dissatisfaction of both parties.
Right. Yeah.
In my case, I think we are satisfied, but they don't, you know, it's just the way they do that. And I'm going to presume that the settlement was in their favor. And
I'm glad something was done.
Yeah, this was really an injustice that had been done many years ago.
It is reparations of a sort.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's exactly the way to put it.
Yeah.
Uber made money, honey.
No.
Wait, yes. What the hell?
I'm very confused.
An operating profit of $326 million. It's first ever. It's the first quarter Uber has ever
made. Seems a little light, though, right?
Money. Hey. It's
picky?
Hundreds of millions
being
more
picky
than nothing.
Yet? No, but... all things considered, it wouldn't that be?
Well, they did have $9.2 billion in revenue.
Oh.
But making money is a good thing.
Okay.
Although, earlier today, Wired Magazine published an interview with Uber's new CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, who probably takes some credit for turning the company around.
Oh, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
The author told Khosrowshahi, boy, it's hard to say his name, how do you say it, Jeff? Go ahead, give it to me.
I don't even know.
Khosrowshahi, I think.
Khosrowshahi. The author told the CEO that he took a 3-mile Uber ride and it cost him $50. Khosrowshahi said, "Oh my God." And this is, in fact, how Uber has started to make profit. I don't know if you've noticed, but Uber rides have gotten a lot more expensive.
Oh, yeah. I haven't.
Goodness.
I haven't used them since that previous CEO, never really
thought to
Travis
go back.
Kalanick,
yeah.
It's a lot easier to
the
say.
The broiest bro of Brotown.
And he was the bro.
But I just never really had a reason to go back. And hearing $300 million, it, I don't know, it just seems low to me for a company
again,
that's got that many
anything is
independent contractors, you know. But yeah, and yeah, just, I get they were making money.
They were predicted to have a model that was, and I mean, I was one of the people predicting it, that would never
make
ever,
money. Yeah.
Yeah. So the fact that they've done something, it's a, you know, one time, whatever, because they,
so I didn't know that.
I commend the fact if they're actually, you know, this is that big, issue of trying to, what is it? Shitification, right? The Cory Doctorow.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great term, right? And it comes in, and with Uber, it was, they just taxis, everyone hated taxis in most cities. Most people hated most taxi experiences with few exceptions. So Uber said, we have something better and we're going to fund it so massively that we can destroy this terrible industry you don't like for something more predictable. And then, of course, the industry is destroyed and now they raise prices. You're like, oh, well, the experience is still better on Uber than the average. I mean, we all took taxis.
And I guess
the
they're doing something right
in the
because
past and,
people say take an Uber, even if they're using a service like Lyft.
That's true.
So I guess
Cory, by the way, has a new Kickstarter, a new book, The Internet Con, How to Seize the Means of Computation. It does. It's actually kind of the sequel to his whole shitification story. So,
so fun to say.
Yeah. And,
well, this is for the audiobook. He won't do it on Amazon because Amazon requires.
Oh, this is to raise money to do the audiobook.
Yep.
Ah, great. Right.
Verso is the publisher of the book.
Awesome.
We've had offers. We've had people asking if we're going to do an audiobook of Shit Happens, by the way. It'll like, be a 70,000-hour book, but sure. Cory's book a little shorter.
Verso publishes the actual book September 5th, and Cory's raising money for the audiobook because he refuses to go through Audible because he doesn't like DRM. Cory and his co-author of his previous book, Choke Point Capitalism, Rebecca Giblin, will be on Twit. They're going to do a Twit takeover October 20th. So, I decided Cory is so good and he's so eloquent. And it's very hard when Corey's on to get a word in edgewise.
Oh, yeah.
He's so good.
Because you don't want to stop him.
You just want to listen.
It's a train.
So I
went to dinner once with Cory and two friends who are sci-fi fans and who knew his work. And I do not believe they said more than three words the whole dinner. And they were okay with that.
Oh, yeah. You just want to sit and listen. Yeah.
Wow.
So I decided the best way to have Cory on Twit would be to have him on with his co-author. And we'll just do that. They can work it out between, and I'll just sit back and enjoy.
I'll be here to bring you coffee and snacks during
those
3 hours.
This Sunday.
Enjoyable person.
I love Cory deeply. Yeah. He's been on Twit so many times, even back in the early days. He's been on Twit for more than 18 years. Mike Masnick will be on next week on Twit, along with Yanko Rector.
Mike Masnick, major media figure.
Did you see the article Kashmir Hill wrote about him?
A little puff
fancy
piece about our friend Mike.
Really nice.
I gave him a hard time about the photos. I was like, would they not let you outside? He's like, wow, there seem to be limited opportunities to take photos outside. But besides, I mean, the photos are good, but I'm like, they're leaning up against the, you know, in the office. I'm like, come on, get this man better photos.
This is like, we got 3 minutes to take the pictures.
Let's put a fig tree in the background.
Put a fig tree and let's do it. Yeah.
Well, they want him to look like a geek. You know.
I know. I just think it's
he's fantastic.
Just, I feel bad.
Cash Hill did a great story on him. We'll give him a really hard time about the about
that's
the piece.
That's a feather in his cap. He deserves this attention. He's so.
I wouldn't say
he's unheralded, but I loved seeing him get out to a broader audience because he's so smart and so right, and also. Let's say not necessarily humble. He knows how good he is, but he admits when he's wrong. He revises his opinions publicly, and that's a great thing.
It's funny. I mentioned Cory Doctorow and Mike Masnick in the same breath, and I do in my mind kind of think of them as equally intellectual heavyweights, fascinating speakers, and more than welcome guests on our show. So a couple of people.
Mike said on Tech Dirt that he got a call that Kashmir, being a good reporter, called lots of people, and somebody called and said, the New York Times is called snooping around about you.
They were worried it was a hit piece. They said they're going to do a hit piece on you. It was not a hit piece, needless
not
to
all.
Say.
Yeah,
it was quite
well deserved. And, you know, I think it's so important now. We see the same, you know, Tristan Harris and Roger McNamee and on and on and on. We see the same people get quoted all the time.
Yeah.
Just somebody who does the real research. And Mike's an amazing amalgam because he's not at a university, but he's a scholar and he does papers. And his paper, Protocols Not Platforms, was extremely influential, including to Jack Dorsey. We have Blue Sky because of it. Mike is a journalist and a scholar at the same time, and a gentleman.
Yeah. And as,
one missing that breath is Chris Segoyan. I miss Chris Segoyan because he went into government and he can't talk publicly. So Ron, DeFazio, rather, from Oregon, the senator from Oregon, who was praising Mike Masnick in this article. I think Chris Segoyan's still working for him. It means we lose his voice, but he's involved in public policy, which is fantastic.
That happens. You know, we had Matt Cutts on the show a lot. Then he went to work for the government. Now he's retired, by the way, and we can't get him on the show.
He
retired from the government. I don't know what he's doing, but we can't get him on the show.
He's in Canada, isn't he? He's married now, I think.
Yeah, he's got a life. Happy. And as you know.
Well, imagine that, a life.
It doesn't go with being on any of our shows. Let's take a little break. Lots more to come. Great panel. It's lovely to have you, Glenn. Always indeed. Like seeing you, having you on. And I guess now the shift happens is, I mean, are you kind of done doing stuff for it or?
No, we got to get several thousand books into people's hands. Fortunately, I'm not labeling myself or anything. we're not that insane, but it's 60,000 pounds of books we had printed.
Wow.
So we have to get them.
You're not carrying them to each subscriber, I presume.
That was an extra. That was the premium level as we show up at your house and we throw it through the window.
Ed McMahon's here with a big check. Oh, no, wait a minute. It's Glenn Fleischman with a big book.
Who's doing the fulfillment?
Our printer is doing domestic fulfillment.
Oh, nice.
And international fulfillment's going to be handled by another warehouse we're still settling on. We think we have the right people, and we have to freight like 20,000 pounds of books to those people to do the international.
What proportion
that's crazy.
Audience was international?
About 30-something%,
wow.
Which is impressive given that it's almost $50 to ship the book overseas. About that. It's overseas shipping is, or non-U.S. shipping now is just outrageous. It's so expensive for everybody. So, but strangely, it's cheaper to ship stuff from most countries to us than it is for us to ship to most countries. So I don't know how that works.
I wonder, Blackwell's, I buy books from Blackwell's all the time because I can buy British books when they come out. They also sell American books at a discount. I wonder how they do it with the British books. I guess they must just drop ship a whole bunch over and then ship them from here.
I think that's it. I think they stick them on a fast boat or on a plane, on a cargo plane at low rates to fill up space. The excitement of logistics. I mean, come on.
Thank you for joining us on This Week in Logistics. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation.
What do you think about Yellow going bankrupt?
Wow.
Yellow's orange.
Oh, wow. Doctor. So I read a good article about this. I think it was a CNBC. Yellow is a particular kind of trucker. They are kind of short haul truckers, and they don't fill the truck. They put a pallet on and they deliver it and they go back and another pallet, as opposed to long haul truckers that fill the truck. And it's very hard to get a job with these short haul truckers because people want to. The jobs, they want to come home at night every night. And the long-haul truckers have a huge turnover because it's such a hard job. You're driving. You sleep in the back of the truck. And, you know, it's not an ideal job. So these are a lot. I think they said 30,000 jobs that are going to be very hard for those people to get new jobs because there's just not a lot of turnover in this particular part of trucking. Meanwhile, the Teamsters did make a deal with UPS, or UPS made a deal with the Teamsters.
Yeah.
And UPS will continue to deliver all of my Amazon goodies from now on, which is good. Let's take a break. Our show brought to you today by Panoptica. In the rapidly evolving landscape of cloud security, Cisco Panoptica is at the forefront, revolutionizing the way you manage your microservices and your workloads with a unified and simplified approach to managing the security of cloud-native applications over the entire lifecycle. Panoptica simplifies cloud-native security by reducing tools, vendors, and complexity. By meticulously evaluating them for security threats and vulnerabilities, Panoptica ensures your applications remain secure and resilient. Panoptica detects security vulnerabilities on the go in development, testing, and production environments, including any exploits in open source software. It also protects against known vulnerabilities in container images and configuration drift. all while providing runtime policy-based remediation. As Cisco's comprehensive cloud application security solution, Panoptica ensures seamless scalability across clusters and multi-cloud environments. It offers a unified view through a simplified dashboard experience, reducing operational complexity and fostering collaboration among developers, SREs, and SecOps teams. Take charge of your cloud security and address security issues across your application stack faster and with precision. Embrace Panoptica as your trusted partner in securing APIs, serverless functions, containers, and Kubernetes environments, allowing you to transform the way you protect your valuable assets. Learn more about Panoptica at panoptica.app. Panoptica.app. We thank them so much for supporting This Week in Google. Welcome, Panoptica. The light bulb.
Did it go off in your head?
Yes. No more. I have an LED light bulb in my head from now on. As of yesterday, it is now illegal to sell incandescent light bulbs in the United States. Now, you may say, wait a minute, I thought that happened years ago. Well, it did. Congress passed a bill, I think, in 2017. Donald Trump overruled it, but the Biden administration brought it back. And as of yesterday, you can only buy energy-efficient LEDs or, I guess, CFL light bulbs. No more incandescent or halogen incandescent light bulbs.
Edison is gone.
I don't like this.
It's the Edison parenthesis. There's your next book.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Good call.
You don't like it? Yeah, you like your incandescence? Well, you're in no. The light.
Well, the thing is, I don't like this being like right now. Let's put this in place January 1st or something like that, because I get that I have some privilege and yeah, I can go and buy a $5 to $7 LED bulb without
Oh, they're
an
cheaper.
Issue.
LEDs are now at 99 cents. They're the same cost as incandescent.
They finally gone down because for the longest they were not.
Yeah. Okay, I think that might have been one of the stop. You know, this was supposed to happen in 2014.
Okay.
Yeah. But it has.
I quit looking.
Yeah. It's been a year now that manufacturers and retailers have known that the Department of Energy would start enforcing the law, suing companies that sell incandescent.
Oh, my gosh.
Lights.
I had no idea they were so inexpensive because I haven't had to buy any since like 5 or 7 years ago when I replaced.
That's what I'm saying. I was like, I didn't know because
I had no idea. Actually.
You know, but I have some privilege there. So.
Well, and the other thing to remember is when you buy LED light bulbs, to get the 2700K or less, get warmer ones because there are a lot of blue ones that are not good. But the more modern ones. Here are $1. They're about $1 each. Here's Sylvania makes. LED light bulbs for $1.35 each.
A 24-pack for $26. This is amazing.
Well, $1.12.
Count me in, Mr. Pruitt. I'm in the same camp. I'm
that's all right.
I mean, when I bought them years ago, I thought, well,
they were $100 when my first LED light bulb was $100, and I got it from C. Crane.
I don't doubt you bought the most expensive bulbs possible.
No, I got the first ones. Bob Crane of C. Crane said, he held it up. He said, someday all bulbs will be like this. But I said, but it's $99. He said, yeah, but you never replace it. Now, when I have LED everywhere.
Yeah.
And nowadays, I love it. I go up on the ladder, I put it in, I say, honey, I'll never have to put another bulb in this socket.
Is the Livermore light bulb still on?
Yeah. You know what, the firehouse light bulb? I think it is.
Oh,
yeah,
I have to let Hardhead know because he's been wanting LEDs for his room, LED bulbs for his room. So what he's done as an alternate is put LED strips around his room. But
the bulbs are cheap now.
The bulbs are.
And they last. And the other thing is they last a really long time.
Right. I didn't know, but. I'll let him know so he can spin his own.
Here it is. Livermore, California's Centennial Light. Actually, this website looks like it came from 1896. Home of the world's longest burning light bulb.
Well, you know, in those days, the websites were made of flaw.
There it is. There it is.
That's amazing. Oh,
it's
live.
Well, wait a minute. That's live from 2015. It's an incandescent light bulb. The old webcam has been replaced.
3 frames
Click
a second.
The image below for a larger view. It's in a firehouse in Livermore. That's live.
Friend of mine for the Chicago Tribune, a good friend of mine, you know, did the feature story about it because everybody does it. It's the easiest feature story on earth.
Yeah. We used to do, I think, on KNBR when I was working in San Francisco radio, C.J. Bronson, the DJ, would do a weekly check. She would call
the Livermore.
I think she just wanted to talk to the fireman. I don't know. But she would call and say, is it still burning?
Is it still burning?
Yeah, it's still on. Okay, thanks.
I'll tell you
Patch
a great mystery
a story.
That's up there.
James
Hugh Hauser, man. That's what
when my kids
like.
Were little, they were very into firefighters. And my wife was on a bus once with them and ran into somebody who worked for the fire department. And they, she said, the fire, you know, we had firemen in our neighborhood. I can't remember what it was at the time. Wasn't a fire in our house. How do we thank them? And she said, oh, bring ice cream, but in round containers. Get the round containers, not square ones. And we're like, what is that about? Firefighters eat a lot of ice cream, apparently. They go through a lot of calories. And it's like everything is birthday cake and ice cream. But the reason was it took us years to find out. I finally asked a fireman. He's like, oh, the round ones are premium. The square ones, they just cut them off.
Oh, you don't want that dryer's crap.
Oh, my God. They just cut that from
stuff.
A block. Yes.
Actually, it's interesting that that light bulb's gone for so long, but normally incandescent bulbs do burn out a little.
From a photography standpoint,
mm-hmm.
was there any quality to an incandescent light bulb that's now lost?
No, I didn't like incandescents for
we
photography.
We don't use them. They're too hot. Amazing. They use too much power. We use fluorescent and LEDs here. We have for years.
Yep.
The problem was LEDs. You know, my daughter's sensitive to LEDs because of the
flicker.
The flicker.
Frequency.
Yeah. And so neurologically, it bothers. It gives her a migraine.
Oh.
So she can't.
They haven't improved that or no? Is it still the same refresh rate? I thought there were.
Well, and the worst thing is the way you dim a LED bulb is by slowing the flicker. So it flickers worse.
Oh.
So it isn't for her, she. And I think there are, of course, some reasons you might want to still use a incandescent bulb. According to the rule, appliance lamps, black light lamps. Do you still have that black light poster, Jeff?
Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix up, yeah.
Colored lamps, G-shaped lamps, the diameter 5 inches or more, general G-shaped. Service fluorescent lamps, high-intensity discharge lamps. These are all still legal. Infrared lamps. Lamps that do not have Edison screw bases.
Edison screw base? What's that?
That tells you how old this technology is.
Jeez.
Lamps that have a wedge base or pre-focus base left-hand thread lamps. They don't make left-hand thread LED bulbs, apparently.
What?
Marine lamps, marine signal service lamps, mine service lamps. You don't want an LED in the mine. MR-shaped lamps that have a first number symbol equal to 16. And have a lumen output equal to or greater than 800. Other fluorescent lamps, plant light lamps, R20 short lamps, reflective lamps. Anyway, there's a long list of. Oh, and traffic signals. There apparently are some traffic signals with incandescence. But generally speaking,
plant lamps.
That 40 watt bulb that you put in the lamp over your reading chair. Got it.
Oh, it was a 144 year run.
Also, Mr. Jarvis, putting those in photography soft boxes, you probably burn up a soft box.
Oh, yeah, they're hot.
They're so daggum hot.
Yeah. Trump blocked the phase out of incandescent light bulbs in 2019 because it was controversial. You know, same thing with gas stoves. I want to keep my gas stove.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't care if it's putting benzene in the air and killing my kids. I want my gas stove.
I've been hearing that, but damn it, I love my stove too.
You know, if you like your stove, you can keep your stove. That's the, that's probably a bad motto.
Oh, the good old
new
days.
Houses.
Just watch out for the stove death panels. I'm just saying.
That's
okay?
Right.
There, Sam Altman has, who is of course the founder of OpenAI, also has a crypto coin currency called WorldCoin.
Oh goodness!
Which is now being banned in some countries. They just banned it in Kenya, where you get $50 of WorldCoin for scanning your iris,
nothing in the United States. You know that he'll pay you nothing in America, and people are still lined up to do it.
Because it's cool.
There was a whole thing in, was it Matt Levine wrote about it recently in his money column for the email newsletter for Bloomberg that, you know, the question is, what would you what do you want to have your eyeball scanned? It's like, well, in some countries, it's $50. In the United States, people are like, well, I'll get some WorldCoin for it. He's like, on being informed that they would get no WorldCoin, I said, well, maybe I'll get some in the future, one participant said.
Oh, wow.
Just scan me. Get it over with.
Oh, my God. So, take my eyes.
This is from Rest of World, which is a really great publication.
Really is.
Westofworld.org.
Sophie Schmidt.
Announced at the height of the NFT craze, WorldCoin is one of the most ambitious projects to emerge from the blockchain boom using a combination of cryptocurrency and biometric registration to create a new kind of global identity service. WorldCoin claims more than 2 million people have registered for the service. It is now officially launched. This was all in beta, but it just launched July 24th. They have set up booths in 20 cities around the world where curious users can register.
And what's why does he want all these irises? IRI.
Well, I think it's because.
All right, this right here
is for identity, right?
They want using a combination of cryptocurrency and biometric registration to create a new kind of global identity service.
So we know you are
that
you.
That sounds a little scary.
You can sandpaper your fingerprints off. I don't know what you're going to do with your irises.
Oh, wow!
Leak.
Yeah. Well, and it is now, you know, it has been, Kenya suspended it because of the privacy issue.
Of course, I use my iris to get on the plane faster now, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
You
have no problem with that, right?
Yeah, I use Clear.
So I think one of the things I saw somebody say is, look, we were giving away our personal information for nothing. At least now we get 50 useless crypto 50. Coins.
Except in the U.S. where he can offer you nothing and people will still do it. Yeah. Not even
free
WorldCoin,
NFT.
You don't even get, so, just want to be part of it.
I know you talk a lot about decentralized platforms such as, you know, what's going on with Fediverse and ActivityPub. Will you ever feel differently about decentralized banking?
No, I understand the need for that. And there are a lot of countries, unlike the U.S. where banking is ubiquitous, there are a lot of countries, primarily in the underdeveloped world, where you don't people are unbanked.
Unbanked, yeah.
And that's a problem.
We've talked a lot about that on Floss Weekly.
Yeah.
Over the last several months.
No, I mean, obviously, that's a problem that should be solved. Because otherwise you get usurious companies, you know, doing, you know, payday loans and things.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not.
Ugh.
Yeah. So you can download World App now, the first protocol-compatible wallet. Reserve your share after visiting the orb, the Eye of Sauron, we like to think of it as, a biometric verification device. You'll receive a World ID, which lets you prove you're a real and unique person online while remaining completely private. So that's kind of interesting. As a global distribution of orbs is ramping up, you can find the closest one in book time to be verified at worldcoin.org. I understand the need for, and I'm not against the need for authentication that is private, but I don't know. This is very weird.
Well, whom do you trust? That's the other issue.
Yeah, you have to trust Sam.
Right. Elon comes back and buys this.
But I think it is aimed at the unbanked, right?
I assume.
Yeah. It makes me very, very nervous.
When I was in Lagos, I was giving a speech some years ago. I was just amazed at the banking is entirely done on phones. And in ways that, you know, we can't imagine here. It's the mother of necessity.
Yeah.
Enables all kinds of other different systems.
Yeah, so the idea is a global privacy-forward authentication service. Yeah, I don't know. And where's your retinal scan stored?
Yeah, who has it? and what are they doing with it after they get it?
Yeah,
you know, how are we going to build up that level of trust?
Are they saving the actual retinal scan or do they save a hash? You know, that would be the best way, privacy forward, to do this is create a hash of the retinal scan, store that. It can't be reversed. It can't. And then so all you could do is authenticate with it.
There's so much trust in that, that you believe that one would believe that they're doing it the right way.
Yeah.
Without outside auditing and ongoing auditing to know that they were.
We will keep an eye on this. We will.
Oh, yeah, you're going to be on the orb, are you?
That was too easy.
There's billions, tens of billions of dollars in remittances that get sent from migrants, refugees and others back to their home country, to families and so forth. And there's so many fees collected, and it's a goal. I think it's a group of the UN that's been trying to reduce the fees of remittances over like some number year goal. And they've actually have managed to do it. The average fee paid has gone down.
Good.
But, you know, when I look at something like this, I think, I don't know if this is the solution. Let's even pretend it isn't, just say for argument, but something would be great for a way for people to transfer money legitimately back to their families, because they're getting ripped off and there's no reason for it, because they're handing over cash. And the people on the other side are getting cash. It's not really, it's no credit or other situation. Yeah. It's simply a inefficiency in the system.
Wasn't like the narrative here in the U.S. was always related to drug transactions and trafficking when it came to decentralized banking. Was that
exactly?
Yeah,
exactly. But I think it's still the case. But that's the decentralized banking doesn't mean a total lack of accountability. It just means that no one is an intermediary who gets to kind of shave money off it. Mm-hmm. I think. I mean, that's one view. I'm probably being too regulatorily bought into to say that.
The FAQ at the worldcoin.org site says they collect no personal data. Individuals who want to receive a world ID are not required to share their name, phone number, email address, or home address.
Cool.
The images collected by the orb are used to generate a unique iris code and then immediately deleted once the code is created, unless the user opts into data custody. You could also opt into a newsletter and give them an email address.
Well, they just want a unique identifier, is what they're saying.
Yeah. So it is kind of what I was describing, which is they probably make a hash out of the information, destroy the information. The hash is a one-way hash. So all it could be used is, okay, scan your eye. Yeah, that's somebody in the database.
Okay.
WorldCoin users may choose to share additional data, but this is never required. Importantly, the WorldCoin Foundation and its initial contributor, Tools for Humanity, do not and never will sell anyone's personal data, including biometric data. So these are all promises. They're not legally binding in any way, and I'm sure that's what Kenya would like to know. But there is, you know, they're saying the right things. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how it would be used at that point.
Yeah, that's what I want to know, the next step.
So let's see, who is Tools for Humanity?
Sam Tools Alden. For Humanity is a global technology company established to accelerate the transition toward a more just economic system.
Says they.
Tools for Humanity, based in Erlangen, Bavaria, Germany. They have offices in San Francisco, Erlangen, and Berlin. Well, they're Germans. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, that is. Datenschutz.
I didn't say that, Mr. Datenschutz.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I'd like to know more. They do have a security audit that they do. They've done security assessments on it. But here's the problem, of course. You can promise we're never going to sell your data until somebody comes along and acquires them.
Yeah, there's that.
That data is nice. So they have something. I don't know how you could use this, except all it can be used for right now is to say whether somebody
is
in the WorldCoin database. No, it doesn't even say who you are. Just you go up, you scan it. We already have you.
Yeah, you're in our database.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They built 1,500 orbs. They're distributing the orbs everywhere. The orb is a little creepy, to be honest with you.
It's techno fix. You know, we're going to have technology for everything. It's going to solve everything.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep an eye on this.
It's Sam Altman, you know, so we have to sort of keep up with it.
Right.
With everything going on.
But we also have to ask questions about long-termism and all this philosophical thing, too. What's the strategy behind it?
Yeah, we're just going to collect a lot of iris scans. We'll worry about what to do with them later. I don't know. Australians, now that they've tried work from home, have decided that's all we want. Fascinatingly, the Australian unions are taking the country's biggest bank to court, wrangling with the federal government to have work from home become the norm.
I hate to interrupt you, but no Australian accent on this.
No, I'm trying.
Come on, man.
I swore off.
I'm waiting for it.
I swore off. I know. Janie's out of the bottle. Hey, working from home is something that's staying well beyond COVID in the pandemic. I'm sorry. That's terrible. No. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, okay. Your excuse.
Australian. So that's an interesting. I wonder if that become a global movement. Yeah, we want the right to work from home.
Well, did you see? I just put it in the IRC chat. Michael Bloomberg wrote an op-ed today.
Oh, he's dead
saying,
against
why
it.
Are all these federal workers lazy at home? They should be back in the office like they are in my company.
Yeah.
And see, I don't like statements like that because just because I work from home, that doesn't mean I'm lazy. I actually get more done. Right. I get more stuff done at home.
And you get to swear more as well.
I'm so sorry.
I'll put that on the edit list.
It's a need for management, though, right? How does middle management show that it's doing something? It has people there it can wave their finger at.
Not to mention all those beautiful buildings we've built that are now empty.
Yeah.
And all the commercial real estate that is going fallow in San Francisco and elsewhere.
I spent no time in San Francisco when I was out there. I just went from the peninsula up across the bridge, risking my life to come to you and back. What is San Francisco like in your view now?
I haven't been there in a while, but it seems completely the same when I have been in there. I went a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to go up again in a couple of weeks to go see Oppenheimer. And, I mean, there, you know, I haven't really been in the tech corridor, but there, it's the city's not that changed. You think it's sad? Yeah. Have you been there recently?
Yeah, I went recently, and it's pretty sad and or disgusting.
I think it depends on what neighborhood you go to. If you go, you know, south of Market, the Tenderloin, City Hall, Civic Center, there's a lot of homeless. There's a big fentanyl problem.
Market is bad. Yeah. Oh, it's bad.
And that's true. And I think it's true in a lot of big cities. And I don't know if San Francisco knows how to fix it, to be honest with you. I don't know if anybody does.
No. In London, when I was in London, New York, Midtown Manhattan is I wouldn't say as sad, but it's not a pleasant picture now.
Just come
London
back.
Was much more vibrant to me because it was all mixed use. I guess Canary Wharf is sad because that's just offices. Yeah. But where the city is mixed with homes and
that's
offices
the
and
case
shops,
in San Francisco as well.
Just come back from L.A. to Queen Pruitt down there because she hadn't been to L.A. yet as part of my paying my dues prior to football season. And
all right, I'll take you somewhere. But when the season starts, you know that TV with my remote?
Right. And you know how I roll. But yeah, it was fun for us to go down there. But she saw some of the stuff that we're talking about now. And, you know, we rented scooters one time to go somewhere to eat or what have you. And her having to dodge human poop.
It's a problem.
On the
sidewalk. I don't want to blame the people who are unhoused.
It's a problem.
Build more houses where Seattle has one of the worst per capita unhoused problems in the country. We have an incredible shortage of houses. None of the things, they're spending huge amounts of money, but because of inflation and our real estate didn't really take much of a blip even during COVID. We didn't have any much of a downswing. So it's impossible for working people with full-time jobs, sometimes in tech, to be able to live in Seattle as renters. So it's, you know, even more if you've got a service job. You know, our minimum wage is now 17 something an hour, I think.
You can't live on that, though. You can't have a place.
I mean, two people with full-time jobs, if they could get it, and subsidized health care would still have a hard time. I mean, the average starting teacher wage here, teachers can't afford to live in Seattle, unless there are two teachers in one household, maybe.
Right.
So Ant, I was thinking after I left last week, I finally got to meet the magnificent Queen, Her Highness. I was thinking that she should sing a new theme song.
Can she go? Just have her sing it.
Okay.
Well, That might work.
Yeah, I'll ask her about it.
Okay.
And she was very, very happy to see you, sir. She was.
I was so happy to see
you.
I went off to do things. Human beings have to do it. I came back and she was gone. I was very disappointed.
Yeah, we were hoping she'd come to dinner with us, but
oh no, she had other plans.
Better.
Our family Slack said, "Hey, fend for yourself," because I am, and that usually meant I'm going to the bar.
How would this go over in the Pruitt household? China has decided that people under 18 will not be allowed to access the internet via a mobile device between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. each day.
Right on.
The regulator will introduce a graduated system where young people have different amounts of internet access depending on age. Under 8 years old, 40 minutes a day. 16 to 18, a maximum of 2 hours. a day. The content must be age appropriate, and all youngsters will be reminded to take breaks every 30 minutes.
If
this becomes a law in 1 month.
If this were my parents, hey, fine. That's okay.
If but this the, is government the government is different.
Yeah. I don't care for that at all.
Yeah.
Why did you say good?
I like it in principle, not in actuality.
what would your kids say?
Like a dad.
We apparently were the Chinese government when my children were growing up.
Now no TV for you.
Discover this. We limited television access and internet access and we collected all devices before the kids went to bed each night. So there was no temptation in the bedroom. And, then they grew up and we're like, all right, whatever. We'll throw you to the wolves. We gave you all the developmental chances we could.
And now warnings you're under our and kids. Everything. Yeah.
My sister and I grew up with TVs in our room.
I did
little
too.
Tiny, crappy black ones.
And look what happened. You became a TV critic.
TV critic?
That's so sad.
I grew up with a tiny 13-inch color television in my room, but you know what that meant.
Color!
You better turn that TV off. It's time to go to bed. Because that's what it was for.
Just plug the earphone into it with the headphone cable and plug the little earbud in. Yeah.
Mama Pruitt wasn't having that.
You could hear the clicks down the hall.
Good. Do you remember when Elon Musk said that the system of awarding blue checks was, what is it, lords and peasants?
This is my favorite.
Lords and peasants.
This is my favorite.
So he said, from now on, we're going to democratize the blue check. $8 a month and you get a blue check.
$8 schmuck.
Then that's what happened is people who paid the $8 in a blue check were humiliated. They were they were called Musk bootlickers and $8 schmucks. And so now Twitter says yesterday, Twitter added a note about hiding your blue tick. There's a toggle on your settings so that the blue tick, the mark of shame does not appear. You can still pay. You'll still have to pay, but you don't have to show the check.
So a mark of prestige has he turned it into a mark of shame.
Yes. Hide your blue tick.
Oh my God.
That's so funny.
You know, there was been reports lately. I know I was reading this in Ryan Broderick's Garbage Day just today that people on Twitter who are really active and paying and so forth are really mad because there's not as much engagement. And it's like, there's no libs to make fun of anymore. You can't own the libs because the libs went elsewhere, folks.
Yeah.
Hard to own the libs if you don't own the libs. You can't pay for them. I mean, that would be a great service. They should pay people to come back and be abused by folks on the right who want to pay for the privilege. Be like being a jester or something.
There's nothing good that comes of being on X. I'm sorry.
Nope. About to celebrate my ex-anniversary when I got off Twitter a year ago.
Your ex-anniversary. Wow. You got off a year ago?
That was November 20th or something?
Oh, yeah,
something?
Yeah, yeah.
That.
Right when Elon came along. Yeah, that was the end of October.
I just said, that's it.
Yeah,
that's
it. Me too.
Yeah. I had slight hope. I was on your show here with, I've forgotten the fellow's name, the one who founded Evernote.
Phil Libin.
Yeah, who was delightful and so relaxing, and he was reassuring because he is a reasonable person. And then I think literally while recording, Elon did all sorts of incredibly ridiculous and terrible things, and then it never let up after that. But I was like, oh, Phil, you make a lot of sense because you're rational, you're putting things in context, you're talking about how people make good business decisions and how the showman side.
Episode,
and it was like, you're a showman and you know, Musk. And I was like,
was he defending
like
Elon at the time? Or
no, he wasn't.
Really defending it. It was more along the lines of, look, this is a business, and he's trying. Let's think about this as a business person, not necessarily as a platform.
I wonder what Phil would say now.
Yeah, I remember that episode, and I was like, "That's what I've been yelling," and people yell at me.
Yeah,
I thought he was very reasonable, but then, like, literally while we were recording the episode, Elon was banning people and striking down reporters.
Kanye's back.
Totally,
Kanye's back. It's crazy. I'm so glad he renamed it because that kind of, in a way, helped me understand and others, I think, accept that that Twitter was done. This is something new. This is something different, participate or not. But it's not Twitter anymore.
And he said that from day one, though, is my understanding.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. Yeah.
But it's not done. It's still not done for some people who it matters for. and I'm still going to stand. I quote Andre Brock Jr. often on the show. Mm-hmm. He had a great essay in Time about 2-3 weeks ago saying basically regarding Black Twitter, work too hard for this, not giving it up, not yet.
Yeah. Well, it's rough. There's no good place to bring one's community that makes sense yet, right? So that's still the problem for people who have a community. And then, you know,
those guys started, but then it had missteps.
Blue Sky Threads. There's so many. I mean, this is the thing. Will there ever be
Blue Sky? I have enjoyed Threads. I have enjoyed Threads more, especially
Threads
was
much like the old Twitter.
Yeah, with the following tab in there now, that it's that shows that it's my curation of content to consume. It's been quite nice to see stuff and interact with people in there.
I actually set up my account on Blue Sky and I check in there from time to time. It just feels like a empty bar.
Yeah,
they're scaling very slowly, and it's possible to be something, but I don't know that it's distinct enough from Mastodon. I think Mastodon's been great for my personal mental health and business and chumminess needs. It's been really good, but I know it's just really. Yeah, it's a good group. I mean, we met, I think Jeff may have mentioned we were in Haverhill, a number of members of the Twit Club folks were there. Several people identify themselves as Twit listeners, and a few are paying members.
Yep.
It's very nice.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that Threads has done is if you just go to the search button on Threads, for me, it just shows the politicians, the stars, the media companies. You know, as much as people vilify Zuckerberg and Meta, they're there.
Mm-hmm. I don't go to the search, but if I just go to the algorithm version of it, it's cool seeing that there's actual brands there. I can't say that on Blue Sky. I can't say that.
But I like Blue Sky better still.
You know, sometimes I like to see what brands are putting out there content-wise. It sort of trips my trigger far as creative ideas, if you will.
I still think it's an open question whether, I mean, we'd survive without a thing like that, like Twitter, until recently. I still think it's an open question whether we need something like that or what we can do perfectly well without anything like that. I mean, does it have to be a replacement?
What does that like that mean?
A microblogging site that is the...
I don't think we need a single site. We need places where you go to the people you like.
Yeah. But I think the days of that, one place everybody went during the Super Bowl and the Academy Awards and, George Floyd protests and so forth, I think
that was a myth too, because again, no two people ever saw the same Twitter. So you weren't talking, no one was speaking to all of Twitter the way you speak to all of CNN. You were speaking to whoever many people happened to see your tweet, and that was it. It was always small scale. We just thought it was big scale.
Right. But do we need it?
No.
There is nothing. Nothing has to replace it. In other words, there's no. I can understand people's desire
Many
for that.
Many things can replace it.
But people our age, Jeff, have seen a lot of things come and go.
We have, Grandpa.
This is just the way of the world.
I remember clickers.
We used to have a remote control that required no batteries.
That's
didn't
crazy.
Have to be line of sight.
That's not a remote.
Well, my first VCR remote was a wire across the room.
Yeah. Those are the ones. I remember the wires. I remember that, but I don't know what you're talking about. It sounds like some weird witchcraft.
I still miss VCR Plus.
What?
Oh, that was the thing.
From my age,
you'd have the listing on the TV or the TV guide on the newspaper, and you'd point. It was a number, right? You'd enter in the number.
Yeah,
you'd punch the number in.
Yeah, and it would record the program. It would do all the right work. You'd have to set your timers.
The problem being that nobody had figured out how to set their VCRs.
That's pretty fancy.
The clock was always. If someone had put, wasn't there some story at one point about. Someone in VCR design, it was like, I wanted them to put a 5-cent battery in and they wouldn't let me, or something like that, to never have the clock start flashing.
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah.
So that was the ruin of TV Guide. Murdoch thought it was going to ruin TV Guide, so he merged TV Guide with Gemstar, the company that created VCR Plus, and it was a whole legal thing of whether, this is magic technology to make this magic number so you could program your VCR, and then... finally, so we could buy the Wall Street Journal, we sold the whole thing for a tenth the value.
Yeah.
All right, coming up, this week, we've got two segments, our regular segments. This Week in AI, the Google Changelog, and then I'm adding a new segment, the bottom of the show.
That doesn't sound very appealing.
It's where all the spanking happens.
Hello.
Got a great panel. Jeff Jarvis, of course, Aunt Pruitt, our regulars, and joining us, filling in for Stacy this week, the wonderful Glenn Fleischman. Yay. Glenn dot fun with Thank two N's.
Yeah.
All right. It's time for, we don't have a bumper or anything. Maybe Queen Pruitt could sing for this one. It's time for This Week in AI. AI. How about that? Google.
I think you got the beginnings of it.
Google has gotten rid of its test kitchen, AI test kitchen app. It's gone.
Interesting.
But it's been replaced by the web. So they launched it last August. The AI test kitchen was home to experiments, a rotating set of experimental demos. There are three still available, but now you do them on the web. Imagine it. Name a place, and Lambda, Google's large language model, will offer paths to explore your imagination. I don't know what that... List it. Name a goal or topic and see how much Lambda can break it down into multiple lists of subtasks. Very not useful. And talk about it. Dogs edition. Roll with the conversation. See where it goes. Just a kind of fun, weird, open-ended chat. Season 2 is coming for AI Test Kitchen. Actually, there is something new. This is, but it's, again, it's on the web. You have to, it's called, I guess I can't get it, right? Am I signed in? It's a Music LM, an experimental technology that lets you generate your own synthetic music. I do have some samples that I can play for you that Google provided to, journalists. Let me play a little bit of these and I'll describe the prompt. So the idea is, oh, wait a minute. No, this is not Google's. This is Meta's.
That's Meta's.
But I think this is probably the same as Google's. So the idea is you give it a text prompt and that you, it then plays a sound. Google's version of this is only accessible to researchers. So here you go. You ready? I'll tell you the prompts and as you listen to the music. This is movie scene in a desert with percussion. You ready? That's our new AI theme. This is electronic Jamaican reggae DJ set.
First one is a yes, second one a no.
80s electronic with drum beats.
Yeah, that works.
How about jazz instrumental medium tempo, spirited piano?
Yeah, that works.
Mellow hip hop vinyl scratch.
Elevators are getting worse.
It is elevator music. Yeah. But
two out of four ain't bad.
I like the first one, the movie music with percussion. It sounded like Lawrence of Arabia.
I could see it. Yeah. Desert.
It's Indiana Jones. So that's Meta's version of it. I can't play the LLM, the Google. I have to register my interest. We're opening it up to a small group of testers. No longer an app. Do it on the web.
I know the headline was all about it being shut down. From
it was just the app
the
was
mobile,
shut down.
The mobile, yeah, mobile yeah. side of it. But
it was on the web.
Doesn't it make sense to do this type of stuff more so on a web browser at a desk instead of
I don't have a problem with that. Yeah. Very interesting piece at NPR. Movie extras worried they'll be replaced by AI. Remember when SAG went on strike, one of the things they complained about was background actors being scanned and then used without their permission in perpetuity after 4 weeks. This is from the story of working as a background actor on WandaVision, which was a Disney Plus show we enjoyed a lot. Alexandria Rubalcaba was told by the production crew to report to a tractor trailer. Dozens of other background actors were wrangled to the same site where one by one, they were told to step in front of a series of cameras on metal rigs behind glass. Have your hands out. Have your hands in. Look this way. Look that way. Let us see your scared face. Let us see your surprised face, they told her. The actors had their faces and bodies scanned for about 15 minutes each. Digital replicas were created. She was never told how or if this digital avatar would ever be used on
screen.
Like
Henrietta Locks.
Yeah, it's like Halo.
Mm-hmm.
If used, she might never know. No matter what happens, she'll never see any payment. Now, I remember when the actors asserted this initially when they went on strike, the Association of Motion Picture and Television Producers said, no, we would I mean, we would just use it for the show that they're in. We would never use that again.
Right.
Disney did not return a request for comment to NPR. The actor who makes the SAG-AFTRA union rate of $187 a day is a background actor. Background actors are not exactly extras. There's a guild for that, the Screen Extras Guild.
Yep.
I think that they just don't have a line, but they're in the scene, you know?
Yep.
She said she never gave permission for her digital replica to be used in the background of any scenes.
She might have. She might have signed some contract.
Yeah.
God knows.
Well, they have a standard contract, so she couldn't. I don't think she could, under union representation, she could sign away more rights than were already agreed upon. Okay. I'm making an assumption. I'm not a union legal expert.
A union negotiator says, you know, that they can get one day pay, be scanned, and then be used forever. The studios say, no, no, no. The digital background actor's replica would only be used on projects the performer was hired for. But it's, you know, it's he said, she said, you don't know what's going on. So that's one of the very good reasons the actors are striking.
Hi, this is Benito. There's actually another caveat to this, which is that the one part of Hollywood that doesn't have a union is the special effects people.
Right.
And they're the ones who are going to be implementing this stuff. And they're probably going to be the ones next to form a union.
They
then
should.
And then what's Hollywood going to do?
Yeah, they all should.
Right. I know some special effects artists, and it's they have the shortest end of a stick, of a $1 trillion stick. It is the worst. Yeah. They a lot of them love their job. They're incredibly creative. They do such good work. Your credits. I always stay at the end of the film to watch occasionally somebody I know's name swipe up in the credits at, you know, super fast. Well, not super fast. The films have a moderate speed, but boy, they have no, I don't know how they got themselves in this position. Because I think there was all that, Pixar and others were engaged in the reported, anti-poaching and, salary fixing stuff that went on that Catmull and others were allegedly responsible for pulling together. Years ago. But anyway, they're the ones who get the stick, and they're going to have to do all the sorting of the stick, and they're going to be doing all this work and terrible circumstances and no great negotiating position despite their expertise.
Writers Guild's been on strike for 3 months. Maybe the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers has blinked. They have requested a meeting with WGA for Friday. First meeting since the strike began. WGA chief negotiator Ellen Stutzman has agreed to meet with AMPTP president Carol Lombardini this Friday. It was a request from the producers to discuss next steps. So maybe some movement. We shall see.
I will point out that while I'm not a movie extra or background actor, IDG just launched, or what they're called now, Foundry, an AI tool on Macworld, where I've been contributing as a freelancer for many years. And it's not going to replace me, but it's certainly using work I did for them as work for hire and was well compensated. I feel actually perfectly fairly compensated for my work. It was work for hire. But here's the thing. The work I do for them is very perishable because it's answers to questions. I mostly write the Mac 911 column.
So that's
and they
good.
Launched this last week. It's so they're they've trained a very specific AI from from one of the major players against the corpus of their of columns written about answers. And I'm actually very intrigued. I don't feel abused because I was paid and I could use my content and have in all kinds of ways. And I would love it if someone could type in a thing like, what monitor can I use for this? And it was like, here's the answer and here's the column it came from. So it's one of the first times I've seen something like, well, I don't know what the answers will be like. That's, you know, a matter for other people to figure out. But I like the idea that it's not trying to invent stuff. It's just pulling it from a corpus of highly focused information. But I got to keep writing new stuff for them, right? Because every day there's a new operating system update.
So, Glenn, I last week I gave a report on having seen Network LM, previously known as Project Tailwind at Google.
Notebook LM.
And
Notebook LM.
Notebook LM. Notebook.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Notebook LM, sorry. Which Stephen Johnson and company are working on. And by the way, I heard from Stephen that I didn't mess it up on the show.
In fact, he said everybody, the whole team was listening.
Yeah.
Ooh,
yeah.
Ooh.
So that's good.
I guess.
But it's exactly that, Glenn. It's, and as Stephen Johnson was saying to me, it's a new business opportunity for companies. Imagine being able to have a dialogue with the archives of the New York Times or or the Atlantic or whatever publication or Wikipedia or anything and ask questions and have it come back because you know the corpus is working with is not every stupid thing on earth, but is this finite thing with
I remember borders around. Going to the archives and getting a microfiche machine and they'd bring reels of microfiche, which is scanned in images in the newspaper, and you turn the crank and you're looking for a story. Imagine being able to query it.
And you know what, Leo? It was dark mode, too.
It was dark mode. That's why I learned about dark mode. But you'd query it.
And you're, since you're the youngin' here, do you know what a newspaper library was called?
I have used microfiche machine before.
What, it was the morgue.
Do you know what
it was called? The morgue.
The morgue.
No, I didn't know it. I didn't know that. That I didn't know.
It's where all the dead bodies are buried.
Yeah. But wouldn't that be fantastic to have a New York Times LLM that you could query and it would be tied to actual digital images from the newspaper and you could say, hey, what else was going on when JFK was shot November 23rd, 1963?
It's limited focus corpus. And also, I think, as somebody who does a lot of my writing these days, is how to and answering people both in book form for the Take Control series at Macworld and elsewhere. And I love to know what people are asking. And so there will be a huge, I don't know how this will filter back to me at all, but I would love to believe that they'll get all of this, these questions coming in, understand better what people are asking. And potentially, if it's successful or efforts like this are successful, that's an opportunity for me and other writers to be writing more focused material that would actually answer readers' needs better. It would be a positive loop because the AI part would be used to help direct people. And it provides, this is the best thing to me, is when you ask it the question, it provides links to articles at Macworld. It doesn't just say, here's an answer, go figure it out. And so it's actually relying on the expertise of humans, but leveraging that natural language querying. I mean, that's one of the best.
It was kind of the model of About.com before at the mining company.
Where through
the Google query of the link that came to you, you saw the question that someone asked in search.
Yeah,
that's gone now.
Back when there was no privacy.
See that question that told About.com, oops, people are asking this question. We better write some stuff up about that topic. So when they ask the next time, we're the ones who come up over Wikipedia.
So I don't mean to have a positive AI story, but I'm very intrigued by it. It didn't make me go, I said, well, this is fine. They've licensed my words. They paid me for it. And they're trying something new with it that actually emphasizes my words as an answer, which I don't know. I think that's great for now.
It's so interesting. We are really, I've revised a little bit my notions of AI, which initially I thought really this is just a parlor trick. We're going to tire of it very quickly. By the way, notice how often you go to ChatGPT and ask questions or use Bing Chat. I have a Bing Chat button now on Windows. Big deal. I'm never going to use it. So I think some of the novelty is worn off.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some real significant uses, some good, some bad. I think now is when we get into the real nitty gritty of it. And I've changed my tune. I think there are.
I was thinking about this tune of yours. I'm going to sing counterpunctal harmony. That I think that generative AI, for many purposes, is parlor trick and is dumb. But taking the power of machine learning and then applying it to content. To help organize it, to ask questions of it, to find trends in it, to do all these things, to find further depth and value in it. I think that's a tremendous opportunity.
Yeah.
I would love to see like a library. Can you imagine? I mean, there are expert librarians. I'm not trying to take anything away from them, but often the queries librarians get are, do you know this thing I'm trying to find? The answer is no human being can encompass all of human knowledge, and librarians know how to break it down. But I've often gone to ChatGPT or other engines and said, I'm describe something and it says, oh, this is what you're looking for. And I'm like, oh my, and I look it up, I don't just accept that. I look it up and confirm. And sometimes it will make something up. It'll make up a sci-fi story or a URL or a product. But most of the time, if I describe something accurately, I get an answer and I don't know what human being I might have been able to answer. I'll ask on Mastodon, people don't have an answer. I'll ask ChatGPT and it gets me very close to what I need to know. And that part is exciting. And I wish people didn't feel like they had to say, well, that's going to replace all expertise everywhere forever.
Yeah, I think that's what we're learning is there are niches where an appropriate use of AI, you just described that scenario could apply also to physicians. Who are expected to know every disease possible and all the diagnostic criteria for that disease? Well, an AI could do that better, and then a physician could focus on, you know, figuring out what treatments, how to handle the patient, mm-hmm. and things like that.
More research,
softer skills. But yeah. let the AI say, well, given this, you know, this set of symptoms, I think these are the three possibilities.
But let them come in and confirm. Say, yeah, that's
yeah. The humans are. We're not going to get rid of humans in this process. Right. I don't think. Yeah.
Well, if we're
there's
not
a story I put in the rundown that it's and we know this. It's proving very good at radiology.
Yeah.
And seeing patterns. I also talked to my cardiologist today when I was seeing him for my checkup. And he said that he there's one process he has to do these exact measurements in slices of the heart. It's very laborious. Now the AI can come in. It has done all the measurements. It gives him a guess. It's, it just saves him time, valuable time.
I got to caution you on the radiology thing, though. We keep hearing that.
Oh.
And then it always it often turns out that, oh, never mind. I've heard this many. I've been hearing this for years about radiology. And remember, they applied Watson. They thought Watson, the IBM machine that won Jeopardy, they thought it'd be really good in radiology. And it turned out to be worse than a physician. And they actually retired.
Did you look at this study?
No, but I'm just saying we've seen these studies again
and
again.
But what they did was,
by the way, this study was not
cases.
A huge amount. It was like 20% better than humans, right?
Oh yeah, but you know, every incremental bit.
I'm ready to
I want to be a 20% better podcaster.
AI supported mammogram screening increases breast cancer detection by 20%, according to a study published in The Lancet. It's a big study, 80,000 women in Sweden.
Yeah,
half the women were assigned to a group in which AI read the mammogram before it was analyzed by a radiologist. The other group's mammograms were read by two radiologists without the use of AI. The group whose scans were read by a radiologist along with assistance from an AI had 20% more cancers detected. But again, I've seen studies.
It's augmented. It's if things can be helpful and augmented.
I think that's the thing we're mainly learning, which is maybe being a little more circumspect about the amazing abilities of these AIs, but how they can be used appropriately in conjunction with humans, and there are definitely...
So there was very interesting. Just before we got on, I saw that Reid Hoffman lectured Wired magazine because they had a statement on AI. They were going to be circumspect about it. And Reid was saying, you know, damn it, you should be Wired. Get Wired. And then the editor of Gideon Litchfield came back and answered Reid. And it was the word they were arguing about was just that, circumspect. How circumspect should we be about AI?
Yeah. You know, he wanted Wired to be the cheerleader that it used to be when it was purple text on a black background and you could barely read it. But times have changed. And I don't think that
we've discovered dark mode.
At this point, do we really need a cheerleader in technology? Maybe what we really need is a dose of reality. We never wanted to be a cheerleader. Yeah. It's balanced. I don't, you know.
We need balance because
we don't need moral panic either.
Yeah. We get a whole lot of the panic.
Moral panic?
Skepticism is not panic, but skepticism is not inappropriate.
I agree.
Here's a perfect example, this superconductor report. Yeah.
You were talking about this yesterday. I never could find a story. What?
So a superconductor is something that can conduct electricity with basically zero friction, no loss. And traditionally, this has been at very low temperatures, close to absolute zero. Just like room temperature, fusion is a goal. You can do fusion, but it has to take a lot of heat. It would change the world if you could get a room temperature superconductor. And there was a study came out last week that by a group that said, we have created a room temperature superconductor, a material called LK99. What was interesting about this was it was created kind of with, you know, not weird materials, like normal materials.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been... So I should say that
Oppenheimer goes to the box office and now we're getting...
Remarkable
stores.
this kind of... what is the phrase? This kind of remarkable result deserves remarkable proof, right? Evidence.
Okay.
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
There we go.
Thank you, Benito, as always. He's my Benito, you are now nominated to be my new brain.
He is our ChatGPT.
Yeah. What's been interesting is there have been people on Twitter who've been trying to make this thing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Unless it's dangerous. Sorry, I say cool. It maybe involves sulfur and
No, acid. It's not. It's not that dangerous. And there's been a lot of like chatter around like this is ridiculous. I was skeptical at first because it really is something that would be a holy grail. But like room temperature fusion, it seems highly unlikely. Now, Tom's Hardware has just reported that that perhaps it has been replicated, and that's going to be the real test: is that other people come up with the same results. You've got to have replication. So the reason there's some excitement is if it really is true, it would be a revolution. It would change everything that we know. I mean, if you wouldn't have to cool your computer anymore. I mean, there's so many amazing results out of this.
Yeah. So much loss. I mean, so much of the electrical system, and I was saying the United States, everywhere in the world, there's so much electricity loss to just the friction and heat, right? It's a massive amount of the generation is wasted.
There have been, you know, there's been some considerable skepticism, as there should be. As there should be. And I'm not yet ready to say, yes, they've come up with one. In fact, mm-hmm. I think we're a long way from knowing if that's the case. But it is interesting because if it happened, it would be quite remarkable.
Yeah. So this LK99, people can just go get some from Amazon and
there was a
try this out.
There was a Russian anime fan who says
I heard about
she
this.
Created it. She was on the... She was on Twitter, and then she's disappeared.
Oh, boy.
There have been a lot of these. The soil scientists, let's get the confusion fixed. Rush soil scientist anime cat girl Iris has been up for 72 hours trying to make it. It goes on and on. It's been a big thing on X, which is interesting. And that actually, in my mind, makes it more suspect, frankly.
Yeah.
We'll watch. We'll watch with interest. And I just bring it up because it's another one of those things where skepticism is appropriate. I think that's the phrase, is extraordinary results require extraordinary evidence. And this would be extraordinary. So it would change everything. You'd have maglev trains. And it's one of those things that could completely change the world as we know it. If it's easy and cheap to make. Speaking of AI, here's something AI does very well. Johnny Cash.
Hello, I'm not Johnny Cash.
Oh, dear, I ruined it.
This is a AI Johnny Cash.
I'm a Barbie girl in a Barbie world. Life in plastic, it's fantastic. You can...
The voice model was trained by the Real Mockingbird, and the singing is by There I Ruined It, which is a YouTube channel. It's pretty impressive.
I love it. I followed him on Instagram. It's so fun.
He's hysterical. Or she. Is it a he?
Not sure.
Yeah. And I love the Folsom Prisoners, who are really digging.
It's a party in the U.S.
So very nicely done. But that's a good example of, yes, we heard that AI music. That was less than impressive, but that's pretty good AI voice changing.
Yeah.
Would have fooled me.
Yeah. Uh-oh. There we go.
Anyway, that's our AI segment. Now it's time for the Google Changelog.
The Google Changelog.
If you are an Android user and a Windows user, you can now do something called Nearby Share for Windows.
AirDrop.
It's like AirDrop, but it's for Windows and Android. Okay, so Rich Campbell talked about it last week on Windows Weekly. He was taking pictures of his house. And as he took the pictures, it was automatically copying over to his Windows machine from his Android device, like tethering over Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, I guess. YouTube TV is temporarily dropping the price by a few bucks.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Just for new users. if you want to try it, $65 a month instead of the $73 bucks a month you and
I
are paying. It's very expensive, but I have to say, of all the streaming services that give you locals, this is my favorite. I think it's really
worth mine is scheduled to resume in the next couple
because
weeks.
Of Sunday Ticket.
Well, no, because of football in general. I ain't paying for Sunday Ticket. It's too expensive.
You can see every game.
That's way too expensive.
All right. $250 for the season.
It's not enough.
You have to be a big fan.
Yeah. No.
I got it because, jeez.
you got it because you're testing it out for Twig and you're going to be able to report back.
No, I got it because while we can see every 49ers game because we're local, there is a member of the family who's a Green Bay Packers fan.
And he is awesome.
He's very much a fan. You should see his man cave. Come over and see
it. He is awesome.
Anyway, Michael wants to see the Packers games, and that's how you see out-of-market games, right? Every out-of-market game. We are going to Green Bay in September.
I'm so jealous. I'm so jealous.
Going to go see a Thursday night game between the Packers and the Lions.
Oh, that's a divisional game.
It's a divisional game. It's a traditional rivalry.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
And, we're doing the tour. All of this stuff.
Sorry, everyone that has no idea what we're talking about. Yeah. This is pretty big.
Sportball. It's sportball. Chrome OS. You like the Chrome OS, Mr. Jeff Jarvis?
I do indeed.
Split the browser from the operating system later this month. What does that mean? The code name Lakros, which I think is related to the Greek word for tears. But anyway, it's an effort. is an effort by Google, which would separate updates to the Chrome browser from the underlying operating system. And this is why it's good. Right now, on Chrome OS, to get an update to the browser, you have to update the whole operating system.
Yeah.
Oh.
Now you'll be able to just update the browser, as we all do on other platforms.
Now it'll really be a Linux machine, huh?
Well, what's really good about it is once you get end of life on Chrome OS, you could still get an updated browser.
Yeah.
So it actually keeps those older Chromebooks working. According to About Chromebooks, Google appears to be implementing Lakros for stable users with the 116 release. Google has not confirmed.
Oh, this would be good for the school systems that were in the news recently because of all of these old Chromebooks if the browser still works.
Right. So there you go. That's good news. For Chrome has got a bunch of new features. I'll give you a rundown of all of them. This is in the latest version of Chrome, which is what, 119? I can't remember. You're going to now, four new Chrome mobile features. This is on your mobile device. It will give you, when you're on an eligible site on Chrome on iOS or Android, click the Chrome address bar. You'll see relevant search suggestions based on the site that you're on. It's kind of cool. So when you click the address bar, you'll see a section labeled related to this page with suggestions for other searches like here. You'll also be able to see what's trending. Just open a new tab, tap the address bar, scroll down to see what's trending right there in the autocomplete. Drop it down. Related searches in touch to search. You can find related searches using touch to search. Say you're reading an article, you come across a topic you want to learn more about. Touch to search. So like double click the word. As you see, they're looking at Lisbon here. And you'll get down below a knowledge graph with all of the other things you can do.
You know, these are all neat, but it's a real UI problem is that you just don't know they exist.
Right.
Who knows? If you touch a word,
right,
it's going to pop up wonderful things.
Right. Well, I guess that's why Google has put out a blog post. But, it's hard to find stuff like this.
It is.
Yeah.
They should license that Madonna song. What is it? I touch my word? I touch
myself?
Raise your hand if you read the Google blog regularly.
Let's see. Download bar being removed from Google Chrome as well. There's a new tray UI. There you go. The tray UI. For a long time, it would appear at the... I don't remember that. I don't use Chrome, so you're going to have to tell me. But apparently at the bar at the bottom... No, I don't like Chrome. I use Firefox. I'm a real man. it's good Stacy's not here to punch me. You would get this downloads in the... I guess in a bar at the bottom of Chrome. This is how everybody else does it.
That's what I see in Brave, so I thought that's what was happening in Chrome.
That's what I see in Firefox, too, but I guess it's now...
Oh, you're just...
It used to be
so
down
cool.
here. These little tabs.
I remember that.
Yeah,
I remember
that's icky. I didn't like that. That's icky. So Google says that's no longer modern, interactive, or consistent with the look and feel of other browser UIs or the browser ecosystem at large. So
cool.
Bye-bye.
Now, remember when they'd sue each other over this kind of stuff?
Yeah, you copied my download tray.
Right, right.
Do you use SGE yet? I haven't been able to get into the SGE beta, I think. This is Google's new AI-powered search generative experiment.
Oh, that. No.
They announced it at Google I.O. It's in Google Labs. Now, when you do a search query, you will also get images and videos. So so TechCrunch says, if you're looking for tiniest birds of prey, which I search for all the time, or how to remove marble stains, you will see pictures of birds or videos related to stain removal directly in the generative search suggestion
Amazing.
Box.
Amazing.
By the way, you'll be amused that when I was at Google looking at Notebook LM, they said, oh, we'll get you in now. We'll get you in now. And I said, I have a workplace address. Oh, no. I got to scream about it at Google.
The same old story, huh?
They know. They know. Yep. They know. And this is really good news. Google and Apple have gotten together because there's an issue with AirTags and other Bluetooth trackers being used to harass and stalk and track people without their knowledge. For a while, if you had an AirTag, you put it in somebody's purse, let's say at a bar, and they didn't have an Apple phone but had an Android phone, there'd be no easy way for them to know they were being tracked. Now you're getting alerts. This is something Google announced at I.O. It is now out that a tracker, an unknown tracker, is traveling with you. If the device is found, bring it to the back of the phone. It can read it and it can give you more information, maybe a serial number.
Yeah, I think the only other way around that was this service that Miss Higginbotham had offered to us a while back that you had to install.
Apple offered an app.
It didn't work. It doesn't automatically scan. I have a book out about AirTags and Find My. If you can believe that, I have a book out about everything.
A take control book?
Take control book. Yeah, good. We actually spun it off from another book that got way too big, so I took the Find My part out because people have lots of questions. But I was ecstatic when I saw that Google and Apple had done this because it's been one of the biggest complaints about it. And there's going to be some issues like some people will remove the sound generating part of a AirTag.
Beep at you because AirTags are supposed to beep at you as well.
So there's the new spec. The spec they agreed on is going to have essentially a countervention. A counter protective measure if it doesn't produce sound, which you wouldn't know. There'll be other signals. It'll ping the device to actually have the device do something instead of just making the sound.
What can it do if you took the sound out? The speaker.
It'll start vibrating. It'll put a different alert up on the phone. Where it doesn't alert you on the phone. It just makes the sound if it's moved after 8 to 24 hours.
This unknown tracker is really the key to this.
This is great.
Yeah, and it should be built.
This is good. Everybody will be on the same page for tracking.
I've heard from people around the world, listeners, who say, "Yes, I've got it now." So presumably that will come to your Android device very soon. There is another update that Google would update its Find My Device network so that you could use Find My Device to locate missing things that had other third-party Bluetooth trackers like Tile, Chipolo, Pebble Bee, or audio devices like the Pixel Buds, headphones from Sony and JBL. But Google says that update is on hold till later this year. They're working with Apple to finalize the joint unwanted tracker alert specification.
It's good.
But the safety feature is coming out, and that's important. Somebody's tracking.
Yeah, everyone should be alerted if there's something moving with them. They're also, Apple is finally, in the next release, they're allowing you to share AirTag trackers with people in your family. Before, I think they felt there were too many privacy risks that someone could use that to subvert whatever, people stalking. And now it's like my wife put an AirTag in the car that she normally drives. So anyone else in the family driving it, we get alerts. You know, you can eventually suppress those in the family group. So I'm just excited this will be much more, it's going to make it a better ecosystem, safer.
Prepare yourselves. The bottom of the show is coming up next. That was The Google change log. All right.
The listeners are amazing.
Yes. That's Joe. I tell you, it's all Joe. Welcome to the bottom of the show.
Joe is on top of
it. It's a new segment I'm trying out where we put the really stupid stuff.
Wait. I want to see the paddle again. He managed to create the paddle in that?
Yeah, there's a Twit paddle.
Dude.
Isn't that great?
There is?
That's really good.
No, he made it up. There
made
should
it up,
be.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
I'm going to
yeah.
send that off so to the printers and get that made
yeah,
up.
Yeah, we can get that done.
Yeah,
the S&M
merch.
Twit.
It's great merch. Great merch.
I like the holes in it because that improves the aerodynamicity.
Of course.
So I can really get it going.
Of course.
Yeah.
Do a cricket bat version of it, too.
Yeah, exactly. No, I
My teacher in second grade had a paddle with holes in it.
Oh, you're kidding.
Slap the kids.
Oh, that's terrible. Boo.
So I know that at least Benito is big into Magic the Gathering, right?
No, that's Mr. John Ashton.
I was once a semi-pro. Once.
You were once a semi-pro.
In the 90s.
Oh. Wait a minute. What does that mean? You go around from town to town, have Magic, will travel?
No, it's playing tournaments but being sponsored by like a store or something.
Wow. Dang. Semi-pro.
Mr. Benito.
So Magic, if you don't know, is a card game. You buy the cards. They're foils. There's all sorts of fancy ones. You build your deck and then you play the game. And it's actually pretty fun. The folks who make it... The Wizards of the Coast, right? Is that the name of it? Wizards of the Coast?
Yep. Owned by Hasbro.
Here in the greater Seattle area.
In the greater Seattle area, made a one only, one of a kind magic card, the Ring of Sauron, part of the Lord of the Rings Magic the Gathering set. But there was only one.
Hmm.
The hyper rare card was found last June. The owner has now sold it to Post Malone, who apparently I had no idea. Wild. Post Malone, the music superstar with the face tattoos, you know, apparently
I
big
had
Magic
no idea
fan.
Who Post Malone is no idea.
You don't know?
Very famous.
Well, he actually sounds better than he looks, which is
sounds kind of sweet. The whole he's got this sweet whole article sound. Is kind of like. Yeah, and he likes talking shop with the fans about
Wizards of the Coast. And
he's got a lot of content with Wizards of the Coast, and he's great. Like he's actually really nice guy.
Did he get the tats in prison, and now he's reformed and he's better? Or
I don't know his backstory, but he seems to.
Well, he went to Harvard, I'm sure, and
yeah.
pardon me, Yale.
I was going to say,
Yale man.
Oh no!
In any event, we don't know how much he paid. For this card, but it is thought
about $2 million.
He paid $2 million.
Valued over, right? We don't know if he
$2 million.
I got a question about this. Okay, so does he actually pull this card out in gameplay, Mr. Benito?
Well, that's a good question.
You can. I mean,
but does that diminish the value?
Would you instantly win?
Wait. The deal with the card is that it is a one of one in the art is the print.
Okay.
So it's got a serial number, one of one, but you can get that same card mechanically. In other packs. Like, it's not the only one that does the thing that it does.
Okay.
Ah. The functionality is not unique, just the card.
Just the card.
Here is a picture of Post Malone buying or, I don't know, stealing the card from... Oh, there's a hug from the weird tattoo
man.
That's
nice.
Yeah, that's very sweet.
That's very cool. Sweet.
Yeah. Post Malone now owns... The Eye of Sauron.
I was saying he basically bought the Jose Canseco rookie card.
That's kind of like that. Okay. Yeah.
I see.
Or the Honda.
Leo, there was a time in the 1850s when all men like shaved off their beards, I think, and suddenly like one generation language changed. They couldn't understand each other. Look, in 20 years, everyone's going to have face tattoos and you're going to be like, what happened? When did this happen?
Everybody's got face tattoos except me.
The post Malone era.
You can... Definitely date sculptures of Roman emperors by whether they have a beard. All of a sudden, at one point, they all grew beards. Caesar didn't have a beard. Augustus didn't have a beard. Caligula didn't have a beard. Claudius didn't have. But at one point, I think it was around 200 AD, they just all had beards. So maybe they'll judge our civilization by the face tattoos. For that, I'm going to get a little blue tear. Right here.
You don't want that. You don't want that.
That's a prison tat, right?
Yeah, you don't want to do that. Yeah.
Good what point. Does it mean?
Just get twit across your forehead.
Yeah, I have twit across my butt. Does that count? It's very small. I have a small. I do. You don't believe me? Should I show it?
No. It's not quite your face.
It's not my face.
That's the paid channel.
No, yeah, right. No judgment. I mean, you know, I'm a tat guy. I got tats.
Yeah, that's good.
But I just feel like getting a face tattoo is kind of saying, like, I'm never going to hold a normal job, right?
Yeah.
It's
right.
Like, I'm not going to be looking for work because...
Well, that's what people said about regular tattoos for a while.
Did they really?
It's true.
Yeah.
A friend is a nurse who she couldn't get a job. She had to wear long sleeves like just a few years ago. Another place, all the hospitals required she wear long sleeves. These were just normal, you know, good looking tattoos. They weren't.
Yeah, it was really funny. I was getting on board an airplane and, you know, the stewardess taking tickets and she's got KISS tattooed on her thumb. She's very straight laced looking. And it's obviously it was a useful indiscretion.
Right. That's great. This Week in Tat. That's the
You really ought to think hard, though, about which band you get because, you know, fashions change tattoos.
Don't get red wedding across your arm.
Yeah. So most people have.
And Leo, where is your tattoo? Shall we show
it? Just above my butt.
Yeah, well, no, don't
I
show
sort
it.
Sort of on my butt.
Don't show it.
Saw it happen on New Year's Eve.
We have video of it getting tattooed.
Amazing.
I did it for UNICEF. That's what
that's
I
right.
call it. Yeah, raise money.
All right.
They did it for the kids, the children. Most people have soured on the idea of having Elon Musk come dig a big hole underneath your town. Not Vegas.
Or put a big X over it.
The Boring Company, Elon took that X down, by the way, from the Twitter building. Well, the Boring Company has done a deal with Las Vegas to dig 68 more miles of the hole. There is an active boring tunnel in Vegas right now. It takes you to Las Vegas Convention Center from, I can't remember which hotel. We stayed at the hotel. I think it's out, it's the one of the new hotels. Can't remember which one. Anyway, you can go down and for $1.50. The original idea was, you know, it was going to be a pressurized vacuum and you'd be in this bullet that would go at supersonic speeds. Yeah. And he was trying to sell it to New York to Washington in 29 minutes.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
That's not how this works. You get in a Model Y with a driver, three people in the car, and you go about 45 miles an hour over a bumpy road.
Yeah, that tunnel where there's no exits lithium ion batteries go on fire.
That was my problem.
When I was in Paris recently, my kids said, let's go do the catacombs. I'm like, I want to do that once in my life. Went and did it. You know, you're 168 steps below Paris. It's water's dripping. It's really narrow. There's bones all around you. So prefer that to the idea of getting in this.
I'd rather be in the catacombs with corpses than go in the boring. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Is that the Westgate,
much better.
They said?
Yeah. Westgate, that's it.
Was that the Westgate?
Was it? No. It's that new resort world that they built. Remember, it was a big hole for a long time in Las Vegas, and there's three new hotels in there. It was at Resorts World. And Lisa and I were staying there for some reason. We were at some event. And I saw it, and I declined.
Yeah.
I said, Lisa, we should do this so we can talk about it. Then I thought.
And then you got there. It was like, no.
68 taxi? Miles. The Las Vegas City Council voted unanimously to approve.
Wait. Forgive me for this joke, but how come it's not 69 miles with Musk? I mean, it's right there. How did he know?
It does seem like that he missed a bet, huh?
I just don't get it.
Yeah. What I don't get is why the Las Vegas went along with this. The city council unanimously approved the Boring Company's plan to dig more tunnels under the city. 68 miles of tunnels, 81 stations, still will be Tesla electric vehicles serving them, carrying three passengers at once.
My CES travel days would enjoy the idea of less traffic, but.
Elon was stuck in traffic, and he said, we should just dig a hole underneath.
Yeah.
Just to put it into context, the Boring Company says it can do about, at peak, 4,500 people an hour. A subway train near you, Jeff, can carry 1,000 people a train. So, you know, in 8 minutes can do that many people. They basically reinvented
staffing
this.
Is wildly different. Well, didn't he admit that the whole Hyperloop was just BS to kill the train in California?
Yeah, maybe. You never know.
This article says he claims it's transported 1.15 million passengers.
That's a lot.
That's not possible. I did the math. So since 2021, there'll be 1,000 passengers a day.
It shuts down at 5 o'clock.
There's no way. Yeah.
It's not.
Drivers for the day.
Yeah. It's not.
Yeah, and 100 passengers.
It's not jammed. It's not jammed. Yeah. It really
is. And even in the control of the tunnel where you think he could finally do driverless driving, of course. No,
he's not going to ever build it. He's got so many boring companies.
If you're the parent of a young child.
And this, finally, I was so disappointed to learn is a fake. My first ankle monitor.
If you're the parent of a young child and you're not getting enough sleep at night, I'm betting it's because your children will not stay in their room. That was my problem, too, until recently when I found this ankle monitor in Walmart. This brand is a godsend.
Little yikes.
Oh, my gosh.
Ankle monitor. Of course, you got to screw it in so they can't take it off.
The guy who makes these is, he makes fake products and he puts them into stores. And his work is so beautiful.
Using their app, you can specify a timeout zone, which is the room where your child is supposed to stay.
Wow.
It's sort of like house arrest.
It's sort of.
For extra safety, I'm going to do the whole house.
The kid can't go anywhere
whenever
else.
Whenever my little juvenile delinquent sneaks out of his room, I get a notification on my phone. From this point, there's several different approaches on how to handle the situation, such as screaming at them from your bed or bargaining with them to get back in their room. But my favorite is to employ the built-in electrical impulse training tool.
It's very therapeutic.
This is Leg Boot Legit on TikTok. And it's really good. Yeah.
What's his name? His handle on Instagram is, I found him some months ago and his work is really beautiful. It's, what is the handle? It's, he does just incredible design work to make this work. Oh, Shampooty with, I guess, three O's in shampoo, on Instagram.
This guy's a different guy, but he does the same thing. Here's half-inch copper fittings.
It's so great. It was the A. Nasir, the whole thing about how one of the first pieces of cuneiform was a complaint about a merchant.
Oh.
I mean, it's
funny. That's a good hoot then. Yeah, Mesopotamia's best quality copperware since 1750 BCE.
The feedback card is clay, so you can write your own cuneiform response to send in.
Oh my God.
So he'll post these videos that are done straight, like as if it's a real thing. And then he posts his behind the scenes thing about how he made them. And his Photoshop and actual manufacturing skills are phenomenal.
Impressive.
It's very fun.
That's wow.
You look at some people, you're like, man, some people have all the time in the world. I'm like, no, this guy is making art.
Yeah.
He's doing something.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
These are lips you put on bugs to make them look like people. I don't know why you would want to do that. Embrace the pain champagne. Champagne for singles.
Oh my God. Ooh.
Includes foam lips for kissing at midnight. All right. Very nice.
What's Hi Bob stand for?
Hello, Robert.
I like that.
Hello, Robert.
Yeah.
I don't get the job.
You probably never watched the Robert Newhart show.
Yes.
Remember Hi Bob?
Yes.
Hi, Bob.
All three.
It's a drinking game. Anytime they said Hi Bob, you were supposed to take a hit.
Classic.
The
Bob Newhart show, Newhart, and then Bob. He got all variations of his name.
Oh, that's right. He did, didn't he? I didn't even think of that.
Show.
Yeah. Here's one that's appropriate for Google. This is a little award. Google won. First person to Google the phrase, is it legal to take pigeons from the park for free? February 15th, 2022. I love it that Google gives those awards. I think that's
I
want
to get that for Craig.
Oh, gosh. Some people are just too funny.
Yeah.
Too good. He's got seven of them. Here's another one. First person to Google the phrase fun or profitable things to do with 237 pigeons.
Mr. Newmark.
And then here's another one. Can you make Kopi Luwak from other animals like pigeons? Number of coffee beans a pigeon can eat in 24 hours.
Oh, boy, that's scary.
How to stop hyperactivity and excessive pooping in a caffeinated pigeons. And finally, tax prep help. Does the IRS consider poop a taxable asset if people buy it? It is from pigeons, by the way.
Nice work. You got to send that to Mr. Newmark.
Yeah.
Yep. Final one was defense lawyer specializing in pigeon law.
That's, I mean, good use of the pandemic.
I love it that there are creative people out there doing stuff like
that's
that.
That's the beauty of this thing we call the internet.
Yeah.
Right? How else would you do that before?
No, absolutely.
Do funny things and share.
Well, you could do it and you could put it up in the town square, but no one would see it.
No one would notice.
Unless you're Martin Luther, in which case people go, hey, nice job. Not Martin. Martin Luther? Yeah. Martin Bob, Luther. Bobby Luther? Luther. Bob?
Bob Newhart, Bob. Martin Luther.
Got to get the name right.
Bob Luther.
Jeff, I've come to the end of all the things I wanted to talk about. Is there anything in here that I've left out?
Let's see here.
Most of these I felt were really worthless, but if there's something.
Hey.
No, I moved the good stuff up into the
Yeah, you did. You main. Did. We mentioned a couple of them. Real quick, Amazon is going to expand its virtual health clinic. I'm going to try it. I'm curious.
So it's virtual, though, right? They're not actual physicians.
But it's all 50 states now.
Huh. Amazon bought One Medical, which was not virtual, was concierge healthcare. They've been expanding their health, their interest in all of this. The online giant today announced consumers in 50 states and D.C. will be able to easily access licensed clinicians via video visits for more than 30 common health concerns, such as pink eye and urinary tract infections. Remember, Amazon also has a pharmacy, so they probably could prescribe. Pills would come to you from the... customers can choose to fill their medication at Amazon Pharmacy with free shipping or any other pharmacy.
My wife said they're going to get their health detail, my health details out of me or my dead body.
Yeah, really, it feels like that. Not interested. We'd like you to fill out this questionnaire before we can treat you.
Well, it's also how Hims is doing it, right? All the mail stuff.
There's a lot of online stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazon also really pushing on Whole Foods. They really want to get apparently into the grocery business. That was one of the stories.
Wait, we're going to get diagnosed in Whole Foods? We go to the checker and say, I can't lift my arm like this?
You know what? Lisa got her COVID shots at Safeway. I don't see any reason, not to.
I'd like this box of Ho-Hos and a COVID shot, please.
Let us do our picks of the week. And did you prepare anything for us? You don't have to, Glenn. It's not a requirement.
I've got a thing. It's sort of a generic thing, though, so I don't know. It's a little...
Generic's good. I'll take it.
I've flown so much since last October. I hadn't flown for 3 years, and I just did, 25,000 miles in the last, 2 week trips.
Wow.
And I realized, gosh, the removal of airline change fees on a lot of airlines, which I didn't even know it happened. It happened while I was asleep, apparently. Hmm. So you can change your flight with no cost except they refund you the difference or they charge you more, whatever, but there's no change fee. Makes life so much easier when booking and doing things. Coupled with the airline apps are now sort of good, like Alaska and United. I'd flown them, and during the flight, it's like, here's how long your flight's going on. Here's what's happening. All the stuff is in the app or on a website.
Here's where your plane is coming from.
Yeah, if it's late and... wow, did I have so much better of an experience these last rounds of flights than I think I had for an enormous number of years. I mean, I do have, I got a Nexus, which includes TSA Pre, which Nexus is easy if you're near a border, but TSA Pre plus apps plus Wi-Fi on planes plus no fees for, changing your flight. And I'm like, it's a whole different world. I mean, they still charge you through the nose for things and the flight costs are higher, but I don't know. I felt like the whole thing was a much more pleasurable experience.
Airlines used to charge $150 or $200 to change flights. Yeah. During COVID, they eliminated those fees and it didn't hurt them. So they just said, all right. I think it was Delta who first said, yeah, we're never bringing them back. And then
I thought it was because I had a business class ticket. I bought it with miles.
Well, there are, or often are, especially if you buy online, super low fares where you're stuck, non-refundable. But if you have a normal ticket, everything except basic economy, you can, with Delta, American, United, Alaska, and Hawaiian, they've all ended the change fees.
Creditable, right. If you have a higher, you can pay. I also like, I think Alaska will often say, like, hey, look, for $100 more, this ticket can be fully refundable, not just as credit.
Right.
And with my kid was, going to look at schools. He was doing interviews and auditions at schools, colleges, and so forth. We did a bunch of the, and with COVID, sometimes you have to cancel the flight. So anyway, I hate to say it, but air travel, despite how crowded everything was and everything going on, I had a bunch of pleasant flights and was able to change flights, and it was all very much less stressful than I expected after so many years.
I'm so glad to hear. Well, it was funny. I went to St. Andrews and then London and then back and then Boston and then California and then
You've
back.
You've done more than me, that's for sure.
And well, no, the thing is, I agree. Everything went off smoothly. I didn't have any problems. I changed a flight. But I still had all of the tension, all the worry.
Oh, yeah, you got to let it. We were booked as a family to go to Paris in June. And as we were on light rail towards the airport, we get a notification of delays, which means we'll miss our flight. I get on the phone with Mileage Plus. A wonderful man there has rebooked us, found us four seats together on a flight on a different itinerary that gets us to Paris just an hour later. While we're on light rail, we get to the airport. We're like, what world are we living in?
That's
which
nice.
Is possible. So
nice. It was probably, probably a computer you were talking to and didn't know it.
That's right. He was so lovely though. So perhaps so. I don't know.
That's why he was nice. Yes.
Not all airlines eliminate change fees. The low cost airlines Spirit and Frontier still will charge you change fees. And I think JetBlue still charges change fees. So don't assume, check with your airline. That's a good get. Thank you.
I'm going to lose all my status next year on United.
Oh,
so sad.
Same.
Just to pull me in.
I never had any status. Jeff, your number?
Well, we should mention this real quickly off the bat, is that Facebook has surpassed 3 billion monthly active users.
Isn't that amazing? What a number. 3 billion MAUs. That's half the population of the world almost, right? That's amazing.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah.
Good on you. I would like to highlight a really, really good post by our friend Yoel Roth, Upline something or other.
Yeah, I saw it.
That's why I was running late to the show.
You were reading that? Oh, well, then I should have done it. We spent all the energy.
You actually invested in it.
This is in the Lawfare blog at lawfaremedia.org.
So the bottom line is that Yoel, who was the head of safety, trust and safety at Twitter, and tried to stay and tried to fix it, and finally couldn't take it anymore and left. He's absolutely brilliant and expert I trust as much as anyone on this. But he tells the story of the Chrissy Teigen, Donald Trump. What?
Teigen,
thank you. See, if it were German, it'd be Teigen.
Yeah, it's E before I, except after G.
Oh, Chrissy, my Twitter friend. My ex-friend, I guess.
Not anymore.
Yes, yeah, see, now you deserted her, cad.
I'm terrible.
So the Donald Trump versus Chrissy Teigen tweet. Now, do I have to say can I say the words?
No, we know what it was. No one needs to repeat
it. It was the P word, A word, B word.
It was a bad phrase.
Right. And so the argument that they had in the Solomonic arguments they had a three insult rule at Twitter. Because if you just make one insult, you'll get over it, kids. Two, you get over it. But three insults, they would act on it. So they actually had debates within Twitter whether P word, A word, B word was three insults. And then Yoel said he sat down and he diagrammed the sentence.
Yeah, he had the flow chart. Right?
That the P word modified the A word, which in turn modified the B word.
Two adjectives and a noun those reasons. There, yes.
Yes. So they didn't take it down. There could have been there should have been a hyphen, I think, between the B word and the A word. So they didn't take it down. But that's the kind when people think, why don't the pattern platforms just deal with this stuff? Why don't they take it all down? Why can't they just deal with this?
Yeah.
It was the then president of the United States and a famous star. But even so, the debate and the nuance and the angels and devils on the heads of pins that they have to go through is just amazing to me. So I just wanted to throw that out.
And they have to do it quickly. That's the thing. They have to do this stuff quickly, too.
Which is what the Mike Basmick game showed us. So in the end, what Yoel says is we got into a governance mode where the platforms acted like they were government, which is true. They're expected to act like government. And he's proposing that instead there should be an ombudsman role, not unlike, in a way, the oversight board, but different in the sense that you have someone who's there going to make judgments. And I said it's more like the bartender role. The bartender decides, no, as somebody said to me when I said this on Mastodon, it's, you don't have to go home, but you can't be here anymore.
Yeah.
Right?
I do this on Mastodon, on our Twit social all the time. I had 7 reports yesterday. And I mean, in my, it's set up so that it's in my sole judgment. And I think it's not as hard as it sounds.
I was 3 of those, wasn't I?
You were 3 of them, Glenn. You were 3 of them.
All of a sudden, I got very inappropriate messages.
But yours, I did suspend those accounts. But then there were some others where it was just somebody getting in an argument with somebody and he can call me names or whatever. And the nice thing is, in my mind, Mastodon has the ability to block an individual or block the whole instance from your feeds. And I feel like rather than blocking somebody globally for insulting you, I think the onus is on you to say, well, I'm not going to engage with that person anymore. Anyway, I don't find these all that difficult. I guess I'm not running a national.
But that's the thing. You just said 7 tickets there. What if that was 7,000 tickets?
Right. Well, that's the nice thing about Mastodon is I have a 3,000 member Mastodon, so I can individually manage it. Mm-hmm. So
that would be a lot of really mean and angry people for 3,000 people to produce 7,000 tickets. Yeah.
No. But that's I think scale has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, it does. And I think the new smaller scale is what's going to make this make sense. Yeah. And that's not to say that there aren't
problems. If the bar had 100,000 people in it, a bartender couldn't do it either.
Bartender couldn't do it.
It's not about the style or the ombudsman. It's about scale.
Yep.
Well, somebody came to me on Mastodon and said, well, no, the bar analogy doesn't work because the bartender can't see can't see everything going on. I said, even in a bartender, the bartender doesn't see everything going on.
Nope,
if somebody's getting loud in the corner or somebody comes and complains,
and they deals with it. They get them out, yeah.
Yeah. You have a bouncer.
Right. Well, anyway, yeah, I mean, I kind of like human scale stuff. I think part of the problem with this is the scale is unmanageable. It's just period. I mean, 3 billion users on Facebook, it's unmanageable. You can't hire enough people. That's
there's
the
an
other
AI
half of the population has to manage the first half of the planet.
Masnik's impossibility theorem.
Yeah. Masnik's impossibility theorem, is that a real thing?
Oh, yeah, it is. It is. That content moderation at scale is an impossibility.
Yeah. Oh, well, see, Mike was there first, as always.
As always. That and the Streisand effect, which I didn't realize.
He invented that?
That's
says in the New York Times he did.
Wow. A very Masnikian thing to have invented.
It is. Mr. Ant Pruitt, what's your thing?
My thing of the week is leaning up to an event that's coming up here soon with us here at Twit. And it's basically a quick shout out to one of our members, Mr. Joe Brood.
Is he the guy who does all those stickers and buttons?
No. That's
the other Joe.
That's Esposito.
Joe Esposito. So there's 2 Joes.
Joe Brood is the Leica man.
Our New York City street photographer.
Yeah, heck of a photographer. And I know I always have on my lower third at antpruitt.com/prints. He could shoot, so go check out his prints, too.
I love his stuff.
So we put it here in the show notes. Shout out to Joe Ackbrood. Thank you for your support.
Yeah.
And
one of our great clubs.
The bridge! Oh, no, we had to show me that. The bridge!
I'm going to send you that as a gift. Would you like that?
See, I didn't do that. That was Mr. Laporte.
I did that.
And speaking of Joe, because in the club we have a scheduled photo walk coming up.
Yay.
And Mr. Joe has also volunteered for anyone in the New York tri-state area, I guess. He's willing to host a photo walk as well for members there. Wow. So,
oh, that's cool.
So let me know. I try to mention it there inside of our Discord. So let me know if you all are interested in that, and I can get you all in touch with Mr. Joe.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's a lot of possibility there, and just in club terms, having seen who came out to our events in Boston and London and mine in San Francisco, is I think that localized club Twit gatherings.
We're gonna. I've not mentioned this, but we were gonna probably do one in Green Bay. on that Friday.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah, when we're out there. Lisa and I have been planning that. And I think we're going to do another one. There's another place we're going to be. So, yeah, whenever I go somewhere, we like to try to do that if we can. But I agree. Our community is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And our club members especially, those are the people who, from the goodness of their heart, pay $7 a month to support what we do. Now, they get some benefits, but really it's the whole point of it is if you like what we do and you want to see us keep doing it and develop new content, join the club. You get ad-free versions of all the shows, so there's no trackers. You also get all the events that we do in Discord. The Discord itself is enough to me to judge for work for $7 a month. I mean, it's just fantastic. But Jason tomorrow is going to do some more prototyping of his untitled AI show. You're going to do that photo thing we talked about on Friday.
Photo critiques Friday.
Photo walk. You mentioned end of the month. Stacy's book club end of the month. The fireside chat with with Hugh Howie, who wrote Wool, the Silo books, and Daniel Suarez has written so many great books. That's going to be fun. Lou Maresca and Anthony Nielsen and more events to come.
Yep.
All of this is part of our Discord.
And now coming in December, a triangulation with the old farts.
Oh, yeah. Old fart triangulation. Yeah.
That'll be fun. I'm the first one to get a major club benefit possibility here where Ant insisted that I had to take it with me, even though I tried not to.
Yes, stickers. We don't have the ability to do fulfillment through our full club, so we can't do that. But well, if you come over and visit, we'll give you a sticker.
You send a self-addressed stamp to the studio.
We'll figure out a way.
Don't say that.
You'll be sorry.
Many. Send your self-addressed stamp. And
it has to be this big, right?
We'll fix you.
Manila, 8.5 by 11 manila folder.
We sent out some today. Our continuity staff did some today. So thank you, squad.
Join the club. twit.tv/clubtwit. We love our community. We'd love you to be part of it. And we thank you for listening too. Glenn Fleischman is at GLENN.fun because he's a fun guy. As opposed to a fungus, which is something else entirely. Always great to have you on, Glenn. Thank you for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Stacy will be back next week. Tell us about another podcast you do.
Oh, gosh. What else do I do? I'm up here on the Incomparable Network.
I've heard of them. Did you go to the Portland event?
Of course, the Portland event, the first time the Incomparable group has ever gotten together in mass in person, I was on press in Maine. So, movable date. So I had the FOMO. But a bunch of lovely people.
Micah got to go because he does clockwise for the Incomparable.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes, Micah. I never met Micah. I've met some of the Incomparable group in person. Most of them I only know as people on a screen or as their voices. But it's a good group. You know, you might know one, Mr. Jason Snell. It's possibly he's an acquaintance of yours.
Heard of.
Which shows are you on of the Incomparables?
I host at irregular intervals Pants of the Boot, which is a podcast about how English varies different countries.
Oh, I love that.
It's mostly just fun stuff. We're a little behind, and I know his last episode was last year, so possibly a little behind on doing the episodes. But there are archives, and then I'm on the main podcast on the game. We have a game show episode. I think I did 11 in a row of game show episodes last year. It was a pandemic, you know. It was people had gotten enough of me, I think.
TheIncomparable.com. Great stuff from
the great network.
Truly geeky people.
Yeah.
Thank you, Glenn. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll be back, of course, next Wednesday with This Week in Google and in the club on Friday.
You're
going to do your photo critique.
Yep. Looking forward to it.
4 p.m. Pacific.
Just go ahead and jump into the Discord and put your images there. And I am marking them so I can make sure I can either download them or pull them up there in the chat one way or another so we can talk about them. And going to open up the stage. And if you're feeling, you know, confident enough to be on the camera, hop on to the stage and turn your camera on and let's chit chat about the images, too. So it's going to be a lot of fun. 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific. Friday, August the 4th. And also one more shout out. I wanted to give a shout out to Kathy Liu. Harry Williams was on my show previously, and he's here in the area, a great photographer here in the area. And he has reached out to me before to MC at some of his events here in the city. And every time they've happened, I've been either out of town or in this instance, I will be doing our own Twit photo walk.
Oh, it's August 26th. Oh, shoot.
So I appreciate the love. And this looks like a great event that's going to be in San Francisco featuring Kathy Liu. Light Painting by Kathy Liu is the show.
More information at Eventbrite. Just search Eventbrite for CathyLiu. Jeff Jarvis is and will always be the director of the Townlight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. Please buy his book, The Gutenberg Parenthesis, at Gutenberg.
It's back in stock. It's sold out, but it's back in stock.
So in the second printing. That's great.
Nice.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you again for last week at all the hospitality.
Oh, it was really nice to see you. We had a lovely dinner, and I have pictures. Actually, I think I have pictures of Aunt.
Well, you do. That's right.
Devouring.
Hey.
Some sort of meat product.
Aunt playing Henry VIII.
Yeah. Oh, I don't have it on here.
You don't have it on there?
No.
Oh, good.
Sorry.
Well, the story
from all
is
your devices somehow.
We went to the great restaurant here around the corner from the studio, Cafe Giostra, Italian restaurant, and everybody was ordering their meals, you know, this risotto, this salad, blah, blah, blah. I said, forget that. Give me the ossobuco. And there it is. All right. Give me ossobuco.
I like the ossobuco.
I'm here to
blame
eat.
Blame it on the ossobuco. Blame it on the ossobuco. It's not the bossa nova, it's the ossobuco.
And it was delicious.
Shirt.
Yes, that's one of my favorite
shirt
shirts.
A lot. No.
It should say yes. Yes to the ossobuco. Yes. Mm-mm-mm.
It was delicious.
Well, you did video.
Well, by accident. You know, it's one of those where I thought I was taking a picture, so.
It's funny. Last night I had ossobuco, but it wasn't.
That was good ossobuco.
I made it just with beef shank last night. So dang good.
Amazing.
Thank you for that dinner. It was delicious.
It was fun.
It was wonderful.
Thank you, everybody. I'm sorry you couldn't be here for that dinner, but if you ever come to town, just
let me
know.
It's not a club benefit.
Yeah. We do Twig every Wednesday, about 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. You can join us here and watch it live if you want at live.twit.tv. If you're watching live, chat live. There's an IRC open to all, irc.twit.tv. Just go there in your browser, irc.twit.tv. But you can also use our Club Twit Discord if you're a club member. After the fact, on-demand versions of the show at the website, twit.tv/twig. You go there. You'll also see a link to a YouTube channel dedicated to Twig. You'll also see links to your favorite podcast players. You can subscribe there or just search for This Week in Google in your podcast or RSS feed reader and subscribe, because that way you'll get it automatically the minute it's done. Well, give us a minute or two to take the profanities out. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.
Bye.
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 Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.